Okay, this is Karen Brewster. Today is May 15th, 2019, and I'm here with Bruce Noble in Grand Junction, Colorado, and this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Thank you, Bruce, for making the time this morning to meet with me.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. And so we know you were superintendent at Skagway from 2000 to 2004, is that correct? So before we get there, can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. I started my career in cultural resources with the National Park Service. I worked as a historian, initially in the National Register of Historic Places program in the Washington office. You know, in a roundabout way, that all kind of led me to Alaska because I took a trip to Alaska. Alaska was one of the states that I reviewed National Register nominations for, so I took a trip to Alaska in 1988 and kind of thought, wow, this is an amazing place. Mm-hmm. I could live here. And I got to know Sandy McDermott, later Sandy Anderson, who was in the Cultural Resources Program in the Alaska Regional Office. And as I recall, she kind of invited me to apply for the job at Klondike Gold Rush when the time came. But then I left after being in cultural resources in the Washington Office of the Park Service for about 8 years. I left during what the Park Service called Operation Opportunity. The Park Service was reorganizing at the time that Al Gore was kind of reinventing government, and there were incentives being given to people in central offices to move out to the field. And so I moved in 1994 to Harper's Ferry National Historical Park, and I became the chief of interpretation and cultural resources there. And so I was there for 6 years. Great experience. I loved Harper's Ferry. I loved the person that I worked for at that time. And it was during that time that I applied for the job at Klondike Gold Rush and got accepted for it.
And where are you from originally?
I grew up in Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. And then what sort of an educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree in American Studies from the University of Wyoming, and then ended up getting a master's degree in history from the University of Wyoming. And I went and worked for a couple of years for the Wyoming State Historic Preservation Office before I got hired on by the Park Service in D.C.
And what was it about the Park Service that attracted you to work for them?
Well, a good question. I had kind of grown up in a family that had a lot of interest in national parks. My grandfather was a school teacher and had taken student groups on national park trips going way back to, like, I don't know, 1920s, probably, late 1920s. So as kids, you know, we kind of grew up watching my grandfather's movies and slides and so on of his national park experiences. And he was kind of a commanding personality. And when he was ready to show a movie of his national park trips, it wasn't an option. You were sitting down watching it. So that kind of affected all of us. And then as we got older, you know, our own parents took us on national park trips. And you know, one thing led to another, and eventually it occurred to me, well, geez, you can actually work in national parks. And I think that combined with being in college and graduate school at the University of Wyoming, you know, in a public land state where there were a lot of national park areas, you know, it just sort of became a natural fit for me. And yeah, it's worked out great. It's been a great career.
Yeah, so that job with the National Register program, was that your first Park Service job?
It was, yep, 1986.
So in Wyoming, you didn't do summer seasonal work?
I did not. With the State Historic Preservation Office. However, I did have a summer seasonal job at a state historic site, South Pass City State Historic Site, which is actually a mining site. I eventually published a pretty lengthy article about a historic mining operation in the South Pass City area that was published in the Annals of Wyoming, which is the State History Journal of Wyoming. So I kind of had a background in mining history, and then on top of that, I ended up being a co-author with Bob Spooty, a person who Frank Morris would know very well. And Bob spent time in Skagway, too. But in any event, Bob and I co-authored a National Register bulletin on evaluating historic mining properties for the National Register. And it was really somewhat in that context that I came to Alaska for the first time in 1988. But in any event, the fact that I had background in mining history and some knowledge of that was part of what interested me in Klondike Gold Rush, and I think it was part of what actually made me a good candidate for the job. So yeah, all those things kind of came together as part of the puzzle, I think.
Right. So Skagway was your first superintendency.
It was. Yep.
And did the Park Service provide you any introductions or training to become a superintendent?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was actually thinking about that this morning before you got here. I mean, to a degree, I had been, well, let me back up. Before I officially started in the permanent position as superintendent at Klondike Gold Rush in May of 2000, I'd actually been up there for a couple of months on a detail as kind of acting superintendent, basically because they wanted to get me there as soon as possible. So, you know, I had a little bit of that time under my belt at the very beginning, and I also had some chances to go into the regional office and, you know, kind of meet people there and get a sense of who some of the players were. So all of that helped, but I do very vividly remember when I first showed up, it was kind of like, well, is there going to be a brass band, or do I learn a secret handshake? You know, what happens? And, you know, suddenly it dawned on me, well, I just go to work. You know, that's what I do. So in that respect, there really wasn't a lot of preparation. They just kind of figured, well, you know, we picked you for the job, so go there and start doing it. You know, at the time, I just kind of accepted that as how it was. When I look back on it, I realize it was a little bit of an unnerving situation, you know, starting into a superintendent's job and, you know, having a lot of new things thrown at me and really not a lot of preparation for it necessarily, although, you know, I had worked in a park and I understood how parks operated, but, yeah, it was a transition for sure.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they don't sort of give you a training course on the duties and responsibilities and what administration rules you need to know and things like that.
Well, I think maybe there's a little bit more of that today than there was at that time. And even then, some of that occurred over time. You know, for example, it pretty quickly came up that I was managing two commissioned law enforcement rangers at Klondike Gold Rush. There's a class called Law Enforcement for Managers that's taught at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Brunswick, Georgia. So I was basically told after being there for about a year, maybe less than a year, I don't remember. I was basically told, you need to go take that class. So I did. And there was a new superintendent's class that I was asked to take. At that point, I wasn't all that new. I'd been a superintendent for a couple of years, but I did go take the class somewhere in Florida. I'm temporarily blanking on the name of the town. St. Augustine, I guess, is where the class was. You know, other than having it be kind of a bonding experience with some other you know, new superintendents, it wasn't particularly helpful.
But if you had had it when you were actually new, do you think it would have been helpful?
You know, in a way, I almost think it would have been less helpful because at least by that point, I had some sense of what I needed to know.
Right.
And so that was potentially a benefit, but I didn't necessarily feel like I came away from that new superintendent's class having received the things that I felt like I needed to know. And that was a little bit frustrating. I know that class is still taught. I think it's been revamped considerably mm-hmm. since that time. And I think there was a perception at that time that maybe that class was not entirely fulfilling the needs that new superintendents had. So, you know, I'm not quite sure what the class is like today, but I'd like to think maybe it's a little more on point.
What were some of those things that you felt you needed that would have been useful?
Oh boy! Now you're testing my memory a lot. Things like the superintendent's compendium, which actually became an issue during the time that I was at Klondike Gold Rush. It became an issue for all the national park areas in Alaska. And understanding more about the compendium and how it worked would have been helpful. The other thing, like special park directives, when you come up with park policies and, things that you're trying to implement at your park, I felt like it would have been helpful to know a little bit more about how those things worked. And we really didn't get much, if any of that, out of that class. So those are some of the things right. that come to mind.
What's the superintendent's compendium?
The superintendent compendium is, I would say, it's primarily law enforcement oriented, but it's also kind of resource management oriented. And it talks about special considerations in terms of how you're going to operate the park. This area is closed to the public. This area has a certain speed limit for a certain reason. You're allowed to camp in the campground for this period of time. It kind of lays out some of the fundamental rules that are used in operating the park on a day-to-day basis. So it has quite a bit of impact in terms of how you conduct business. I think that's where, and maybe I'm getting a little off point here, but I think that's where it became an issue for the Alaska region. And I don't even to this day know exactly the genesis of how it became an issue, but I think it had to do with some things at Katmai and some decisions that the superintendent there was making at that time. And I think it came to the attention of Senator Stevens and others of influence, shall we say, that this was kind of like a non-public rulemaking, basically. Mm-hmm. That, the Park Service would put these things into effect, but there wasn't any opportunity for outside entities, for local communities to have input into the compendium. And so during the time we were there, we were required for the first time to start going through a process where you would post your compendium on your website at a certain time during the year. You would accept comments on it. You would address those comments. Once you'd done that, you would sign it and put it into effect. I actually thought it was a really good thing, and it surprised me somewhat. For example, here in the Intermountain region of the Park Service, we're not required to do that. I don't know whether they're still doing that in Alaska or not, but I don't know exactly why it came to pass, but the transparency aspect of it I thought was good, and it seems to me that it could be something that would be more widely adopted across the Park Service.
Well, thank you. That's helpful, and it is a little off track, but it need to define that. So when you came on with your detail for superintendent, was that because the preceding superintendent was still superintendent, or where there was just a temporary vacancy, or why?
So I'll answer that and then some. Okay. I'll kind of pivot off of that question. To my knowledge, there had been a couple of people who had been acting there in a temporary capacity before I arrived. One was Linda Cook. Linda was in Cultural Resources in the regional office. at that time. Bob Barbie was the regional director when I got hired there. Bob really liked Linda. Linda was a smart person, had a good sense of humor. Bob really liked her. Linda, last I knew, was a superintendent somewhere in the Northeast region of the Park Service, which is back kind of closer to where she originally came from. And whether she's still in the Park Service, I do not know. But she was there for a while. After she left, Betty Rickliffs, who was the administrative officer, was an acting superintendent for a while. But, you only know what you hear about things that happened before you got there. But what I heard was that the previous permanent superintendent, Clay Alderson, mm-hmm. I think left Klondike Gold Rush under some difficult circumstances. And in fact, I don't think I'd be betraying a confidence to say I believe he was removed from his job. He was not removed from the National Park Service, but I believe he was removed from that superintendent job. And, I don't really know all of the circumstances that led to that, but I do know that it's a small town there in Skagway. It's a pretty tightly knit community. He had been there for a long time. He was married to a woman who was a school teacher. She was obviously very much embedded in the community as a teacher, as was he as the superintendent. They ultimately got divorced. You'd like to think if you get a divorce, it's a personal matter, but sometimes in small towns, when you're in a public position, it becomes a public matter as well. I think it kind of reflected on him as superintendent in a certain respect. And I also have the sense, and again, I wasn't there, but I have a sense that Clay, who I think had been superintendent there for about 14 years, had gotten to a point where maybe he sort of thought that he had been there long enough that people owed it to him to come to him. He didn't owe it to them to go to them. And so I think he had become, maybe a little bit too sort of retrenched in his office. And I think there were some issues that required engagement with the community that were perhaps not working out quite as well as they should have. So all those things had kind of gone down before I got there. It also added to the awkwardness of being a first-time superintendent. What I've subsequently experienced is that when you start a job, it's kind of nice to have some contact with your predecessor. Sometimes your predecessor doesn't really want to have much contact. They've moved on. But I've always felt in the past like that opportunity has generally been there for me when I've started as a new superintendent. And sometimes it's been extremely helpful because your predecessor can say, here are the things you need to be aware of. Here are some issues that are important. Here are some people that, have some things going on with them. All of that was helpful. I did not feel when I got to Klondike Gold Rush that I was at liberty to contact Clay. He was still with the Park Service. And I felt like it would be awkward. I mean, I don't recall that anybody told me don't contact him, but I just felt like it would be an awkward situation. So I didn't really have the benefit of his corporate knowledge, his perspective on things. Before I left Klondike Gold Rush, I think he ultimately, or at least for a time, ended up managing the FAPLIC there in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
And so it got to a point where he and I were kind of in a little bit in the same orbit. So I did eventually meet him, get to know him a little bit, and so on and so forth. And we did eventually have a little bit of collaboration, but we didn't at the beginning.
Right.
And that was kind of an awkward situation.
And that was, you felt uncomfortable because of how he had left the job and in terms of contacting him.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Not knowing exactly what had gone on his watch, except for what I've been told. And I know some of what I was told is that there are some things here that you need to clean up. But, you know, I came in with sort of those marching orders, but without the opportunity to really interact with my predecessor about, what his thoughts were.
And you had mentioned that there were some issues that maybe, you know, how he dealt with them between the park and the community. Do you recall what some of those might have been?
Well, the main thing that I recall that was really kind of front and center when I got there had to do with the Moore House. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of an interesting issue. The assertion from the city of Skagway was that the street was too narrow in front of the Moore House. I'm forgetting now exactly what street it was.
Fifth, I think.
I think so, yes. And, you know, the assertion was there are tour buses that go through there. There's traffic on that street. There's kind of a, you know, a narrowing down of the street right in front of the Moore House. And the city would like to have more room to expand and widen the street. And there was a real log jam over that issue. I think Clay Alderson, I'm guessing other people on the staff did not think that was a great idea. And, you know, in some ways it probably wasn't the greatest idea. But it also seemed like there was a real kind of foxhole mentality rather than, you know, thinking about, well, you know, can we meet each other halfway? And I do recollect vaguely having some discussion with Linda Cook, who had been there as acting superintendent, about that issue when I got there. And as I recall, Linda kind of felt like, you know, it's not as big a deal as it's been made out to be. It's really a communication problem more than anything else. And so we ended up doing a survey and trying to figure out exactly how much of the Moore House property would have been impacted. And it turned out that it was really pretty minimal. You know, there would be some impact. The park was going to be affected a little bit, but it wasn't a lot. And, you know, we went through the compliance process, Section 106 compliance. I don't recall whether we did NEPA compliance, but, you know, we got all the approvals that we needed to widen the street, and we widened the street. Well, we didn't do it, but we basically allowed the city to do it. And, you know, as I recall, I think they added a little boardwalk in there.
Yeah, that's fence.
Yeah, and the fence, you know, I think all that got added in at the time. And, you know, to me, it didn't really seem like that big of a deal. And it seemed like it was kind of a small thing to do in order to get to a better place with the city, which in general was a need, not just on that particular issue, but just overall. Working more closely with the city was something that clearly was needed when I got there. And actually, I feel like I made a lot of headway on that by the time I left. But yeah, it seemed like kind of a small issue that had sort of blown up, basically.
And I thought that it had all been resolved under Clay's tenure. I didn't realize that it lingered over into years.
Oh, yes.
Because I know it came to a head during his time, and I kind of thought that all got decided on.
No, so. I think that was part of the whole, mix of issues where it was felt like, you know, the superintendent is not engaging enough on this, was my take on it. Now, all that said, I do think it was a small thing the grand scheme of things. However, I always found it kind of interesting for the whole rest of the time I was there. I would, I've got an office job, so it wasn't like I was out in the park 8 hours a day, but I was out and about quite a bit, and I would always make it my business to, you know, kind of look down the street at Moore House when I was going by there just to see, you know, how's the traffic moving, are there any issues there. I never saw any tour buses on that street that I can ever recall, and I never saw much traffic on that street, period, that I can ever recall. So, you know, what I came to conclude was that it was more of a symbolic issue than it was an actual issue. It was something that the city wanted to say that they were able to get done, and they wanted the Park Service to cooperate with them, whether there was a huge need for it or not. You know, that's kind of how it appeared to me after the fact. But, you know, again, I would say I don't feel like, I mean, I would feel bad if I felt like we did harm to the park by agreeing to allow that street to be widened. And I don't feel bad. Because I don't think we harm the park.
The existing staff at the park who've been working on that issue prior to your arrival, the cultural resources, historians, archaeologists, how did they feel about that project of the widening or not?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't really recall.
They didn't come express their views to you?
Not that I recall. You know, my... and. I'm just kind of, you know, digging deeply into my memory banks here. But I think the feeling I had from the park was that we need to move on. You know, we can't continue to be stuck on High Center over this issue. If there was anybody who had major heartburn about it on the park staff, I don't ever recall hearing that.
Okay. So then you said, you know, when you got there, you had things to clean up. I'm assuming that's internally within the staffing administration of the park. Is that what you mean?
Well,
what you inherited?
You know, a lot of it, I think, really was that issue with the Moore House. You know, that had become a real flashpoint. A lot of it, as I said, had to do with just kind of general relations with the city, with the mayor, with the city council, with the city manager. And, you know, the philosophy that I took there is that I'm not going to sit in my office and expect them to come to me. I'm going to go to them. And so I did that. You know, I went to City Hall a lot and, you know, met with the guy, Bob Ward, who was a city manager. Bob was not a big personality, you know, not an exciting guy, but I think he was effective at his job, and you know, he knew which way the winds were blowing politically in terms of what his city council members wanted. So, you know, he could be a friend or, frankly, an obstacle, depending on, you know, what his sense of the politics were. Mm-hmm. But I think, in general, I had a good working relationship with Bob. John Mielke was the mayor at that time, and John was the one who had really, you know, I think sort of drawn a line in the sand over the widening of the street in front of the Moore House. And John, I forget his exact title, but he was sort of in charge of the White Pass and Yukon route maintenance operation. And he worked out of the maintenance shops for the railroad up at the far end of town. Mm-hmm. And he was hard to reach. I mean, you couldn't always get him on the phone. It wasn't like he was sitting in his office all the time. I'd just go up there. You know, I'd find him and sit down and talk to him. And, you know, I think John and I probably looked at the world differently in a lot of ways. But I also feel like I worked well with John. And, you know, I don't know where he is today. I was told that he eventually left Skagway, but I'd like to think he would say the same thing about me. I think we ended up having a good working relationship. The other thing that needed to be dealt with internally when I got there within the park had to do with just how we were organized. And for a really long time, Skagway had what was kind of an old school organizational model where, you know, going way back, there was a time when the chief ranger was sort of like the kind of almost the de facto deputy superintendent, because usually the chief ranger was over the interpretive rangers, they were over the law enforcement rangers, and they were also over resource management. So kind of like the, you know, the biologists and the wildlife biologists and, you know, hydrologists, those kind of folks. Well, you know, as time has gone by, and even then, most parks had kind of moved beyond that because things had gotten a lot more specialized. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily logical that a chief ranger who was mostly involved in law enforcement things should be supervising a wildlife biologist. You know,
right.
So things were kind of separating out. So prior to my getting there, they had already split off the interpretive function. And there was a guy by the name of David Esslinger, who was the chief of interpretation at the time that I got there. And then the next step that was kind of remaining to be taken was to split off the resource management function so that that was no longer under the chief ranger. So we did that, we put out a vacancy announcement, and I ended up selecting a woman, Teresa Tebow, as the chief of resource management. Teresa, prior to that, had been in charge of the city museum in Wrangell, Alaska. And there had been a lot of sort of controversy around the museum. I think she was trying to do good things that weren't necessarily being well received in the community. So in any event, she ended up getting the chief of resource management job. And so, you know, then the challenge became kind of standing up an independent, separate resource management operation so that it was going to function on its own. And there were some challenges there. You know, it was just a change in how the place operated. There were new personalities involved. There were challenges. You know, I think we kind of worked through all that to the best of our ability, but I don't think it was ever, I'm not going to claim it was a perfectly smooth transition. You know, there was one employee at the time, whose name I will not mention, but she'd been there for a number of years. She just left. She was not really comfortable with the change in direction that things were taking. It was a disappointment to me because, you know, I respected that employee, thought she had done a good job. I was sorry to see her leave. I even tried to help her find another Park Service job, which did not pan out, and she ultimately left. And then ultimately, I think, ended up feeling like I was somehow responsible for her leaving, which made me feel bad because I actually would have preferred that she not leave and felt like I had helped to try to prevent that from happening. But
and was her leaving based on the reorganization, or was it based on personalities of people who are now in different positions or supervisory positions?
I think it was based on personalities. And you know, exactly what went down, I didn't really know at the time and don't really know today. You know, I guess what I do recall from that time is, you know, sometimes personalities don't mesh. You know, that's just kind of human nature. But I also sort of felt like everybody needs to get a chance. And I felt like some things happened really quickly, you know, after setting up the separate resource management division, where people needed to be given a chance. And I don't think everybody was as patient with, you know, providing that chance. And I think in the case of this individual employee, that's what resulted in her deciding to leave.
Yeah, and I was also thinking that, you know, a whole internal reorganization with now reporting to different people, that some people can adapt to that and some people are not so comfortable with that.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, I can be an example of that. You know, there have been changes that I've been comfortable with and others that I haven't. You know, that's just kind of, I think, again, how human nature works. But yeah, there was definitely some bumpy road there in that process. An interesting mix of personalities.
And was there also a reassignment if somebody was in one position? Didn't some people get moved around to other positions?
There was, let me sort of think about how I want to explain this. So I guess I'm just going to be a little bit loose in the details that I provide. But there was basically a situation where there was a division chief who I just felt like was not living up to their responsibilities. And I felt like the person was kind of losing the respect and admiration of their staff, and that people were going to end up either being very unhappy, leaving, all of the above, perhaps. And it was an extremely difficult situation because you can't really, you know, you can't force somebody to leave. I knew that this individual was basically ready to leave Skagway, but I also knew that the individual was being very, very specific about the jobs they would take if they were to leave. And, you know, sometimes if you're trying to get out of a situation, you have to cast a wide net. You know, casting a narrow net is not necessarily going to get you to another place. And, you know, I tried to suggest that I could help find other jobs. You know, I tried to be as diplomatic as I could in saying, you know, maybe this isn't a good fit for you, but not exactly coming right out and saying that. And so ultimately, you know, I asked the person if they would be interested in another job that would be a lateral position, a lateral move, right, so that, you know, wouldn't lose any salary money or anything. Person said yes. I don't think they fully understood exactly what was going on, but, you know, so I was able to move the person into the new position. I was able to kind of re-describe the position that that individual had been in, actually bump it up to a higher grade level, and bring in a new person to do the job. And the person that had previously been in the job actually applied for it and was not selected. I think ultimately it got the park to a better place. You know, I think it was definitely a good thing to do. It was a hard thing to do. You know, I felt like, you know, welcome to the world of management, right. Basically. When I look back on it, I felt like it needed to be done for the good of the organization, but I didn't relish doing it. And I felt bad about how it happened, and to a degree, I actually still feel bad about it. Yeah. You know, it's not exactly the way that I would like to interact with people that report to me, but it had kind of gotten to a point where I felt like I had tried everything that was legitimately within my power to achieve a different outcome, and nothing had worked, and so I had to go this route. And it was, you know, I think the employee accepted it pretty well. I think it did finally become clear, oh, okay, this is serious. You know, they did ultimately get another job. I think moved to a place that was better for them. So, and I think that where the park ended up as a result of all that, as I said previously, was in a better place. But so, it was hard.
Yeah, so you felt they needed to be, they weren't being effective in their original position. And therefore that was affecting the functionality of the park.
Exactly.
And then when you laterally transferred them into their new position, were they effective in that position? Was that a better fit for them?
Well, you know, I think potentially it could have been, but we didn't really have a long time to test it out, because okay, I do think that it was, you know, not a whole lot longer after that happened that the person did get another job, right, and left.
And was there resentment from that person that after you moved them from their original position, it became a higher salary and then they didn't get hired for it? Now here's this newbie doing what they'd been doing?
Well, you know, as I said, I thought the employee handled it pretty well. there could have been resentment. You know, it's, sometimes there are things that people are unhappy with you about in your role as a superintendent that they're not necessarily going to come tell you.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think just logic sort of suggests that it wouldn't have been a happy situation. However, you know, I don't think he let that be a barrier.
Right.
You know, I admire that.
Yeah, there wasn't any obvious him being disrespectful or difficult for the new person. Did he create an uncomfortable workplace for the new person?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. And I think even the new person would say that. No. But I think the new person came in with full knowledge about what the background behind all this was, and I think came in with an idea that, okay, you know, I've got to work hard to try to make this work as well as it possibly can. And actually, I think it did work pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was, in a way, was a tribute to everybody's effort to, you know, really try to make the best of the situation. So, I think it speaks well of everybody in that sense.
Mm-hmm. When you first came to the park, did you have ideas in your head of where you thought the park should go? Did you have any kind of a background to know that?
Interesting question. I feel like I kind of knew a lot about where the park wanted to go. One of the benefits of having come to Skagway from Harpers Ferry National Historical Park in West Virginia was that Harpers Ferry Center was right there in Harpers Ferry. They had a fantastic National Park Service library. They had all kinds of documentation about all the national parks in the system. So, you know, I had access to the general management plan, which was relatively new at the time that I took the job. I had access to, like, Frank Norris's administrative history. I think I knew quite a bit about what the background of the place was. You know, I think what I wanted to do was to move forward on some of the things that the plan called for us to do. And, did I have a particular kind of a personal vision? I think I wanted to go there and do good things.
Right. But so for some of those things that you just said that had been laid out in the management plan, do you have some examples?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind, maybe a couple of things that are sort of interrelated. Dai, there was a lot going on in Dai. There was a cultural landscape study that was kind of in progress. I don't know whether it ever got completed, but the cultural landscape study was trying to come up with recommendations for how the kind of Dai town site ought to be managed. That was a controversial thing. I think in part because of the person who was in charge of the study, initially I had a good working relationship with, but what I began to discover over time was that when I wasn't around, I think this person was becoming very kind of autocratic in sort of cracking the whip and saying, I'm producing this study, this is how things are going to be. I think there was some definite sort of tension around that study and about how, you know, the Dai town site was going to be approached. There was also related stuff about commercial use in Dai. There had been, I'm not sure what they called it exactly, but like a commercial services strategy that had been laid out for Dai in the general management plan. And it kind of divided things into different kinds of commercial activities and the number of people that could participate in those activities. It was basically trying to, control the number of people that were participating in commercial ventures in Dai. And so, you know, we were trying to implement all of that. You know, I think actually that worked pretty well. And we were also able to implement, and I'm not going to remember the right terminology here, but we actually had kind of a per person fee that we were able to implement for all the commercial operators that were doing business in Dai. And so, as I recall, it was $2 per person. And the commercial operators were, you know, always, I thought, extremely nonchalant about things like that, because they just pass it along to their customers. And, you know, these were mostly tours that were being sold on the cruise ships. And, you know, generally those folks had money to spend, and it wasn't really affecting the commercial operator's business. And the clients still wanted to go on the activity and brought in more money for the park. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that was one of several things where our revenue position really improved dramatically during the time I was there, because of us being able to implement that fee. But then there were also other issues with, you know, what can we really do to keep Dai from becoming too heavily impacted by visitation? So we ended up starting this, what the Park Service at that time anyway, called VERP Plan, V-E-R-P, Visitor Experience and Resource Protection. And they're sort of kind of social science-based studies where surveys are done. And somebody comes in who's got qualifications in this area, surveys the public, and basically asks them questions about what kind of impacts do you think would be acceptable in this area, and at what point would those impacts become so significant that maybe you wouldn't want to be here anymore, or maybe you would find that it would impact the quality of your experience. So we started working through that process, and I thought it was a really effective process. I think there are people kind of at the higher level in the Park Service then, and I think to a degree now, who were a little bit skeptical of those kind of studies, partly because of the social science aspect of it. And it's like, well, really? We're just going to ask people what they think and then make decisions based on that? But, you know, we started working through all of that, I think, with good intentions. And I know that study was ultimately finished, although it was not finished until after I left there. My impression is that it, you know, did good things for Dai, and that, you know, it did help to kind of bring a little bit of additional order to that part of the park. So, yeah, those were some of the things that came out of the general management plan that I really wanted to carry forward.
What about the Chilpu Trail? Were there issues laid out in that plan for the trail?
Well, I'm sure there were. You know, I don't remember too many of the specifics. I do remember we put in a vault toilet, a Romtec vault toilet. I've been a fan of the Romtec product line ever since then. But we put in a Romtec vault toilet right at the trailhead there, kind of right where that truss bridge crosses the Taya River. I assume that bridge is still there. And that was something that I believe was called for in the general management plan. But I think it was just something that was generally perceived to be a need, that, you know, people needed to go to the bathroom before they started up the trail. So we did put that in. I recall there was some issue that occurred before I got there, where it used to be that there were trees that were kind of planted on both sides of the trail right at the beginning. And there's a term that landscape architects use, like an allay of trees or something like that. I don't remember what the term is, but it was supposed to be sort of a, you know, a sense of arrival, that you are here starting the trail experience. Well, those trees got cut down, I think by the highway department or something, and I think without a lot of knowledge from the park. And that had happened before I got there, but, you know, we were still dealing with some of the ramifications of that in terms of sort of the, you know, initial starting point for the trail. But, you know, I guess in general, I mean, I could say a lot about the Chilkoot Trail, but my overall memory of the experience of managing the trail is extremely positive. You know, I thought it was just an outstanding recreational opportunity, you know, almost kind of unparalleled.
And by the time you got there, the whole permit and campground system that's in place now was already there, or did that get established under your tenure?
It was already there, and the trail center was set up. What did happen that was a significant change was that shortly after, I would say within 6 months of my arriving in Skagway, Bob Barbee retired as regional director. And Rob Arnberger came in, previously been the superintendent of Grand Canyon. It was an interesting thing to observe as a new superintendent. It was pretty clear to me that Rob came into that job with his ideas that he wanted certain things to happen at all the national parks, you know, that he wanted to accomplish things as regional director. What I found to be kind of interesting is, you know, I just observed my fellow superintendents and, you know, it seemed to me there were some people that were working with him and some people that were actually resisting him. You know, maybe they had good reason for not liking the things that he wanted to do. And he certainly wasn't a person who brooked a lot of opposition, so resisting him was not going to be an easy thing for anybody. But one of the things that he clearly wanted to do for the Chilkoot Trail was to see us begin to charge a fee. Prior to my arrival and prior to Rob Arnberger coming on, it probably would have been 2001, when he came on as regional director, there was a fee for hiking the trail, but it all went to Parks Canada. And I think Rob's feeling was he wanted to see the Park Service get a part of that as well. He didn't want to see it all go to Parks Canada. And you know, I don't remember the premise for why it all went to Parks Canada initially. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, they were kind of operating the trail center and they had a big investment in that. And I think it was kind of felt like it was appropriate to, you know, allow them to get some kind of financial benefit. Anyway, we went through a long, involved study with a guy from the regional office who was specifically assigned to help us figure out what an appropriate amount to charge people to hike would be. And it was complicated because when the Park Service charges fees, we generally base it on comparability. So if we're thinking about raising campground fees, for example, well, we look at surrounding campgrounds and say, what are they charging? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we want to be kind of compatible with what the rest of the market is doing. But it was hard with the Chilkoot Trail because there aren't that many places that charge you to hike.
Right.
So, you know, figuring out what the appropriate amount would be was not easy. As I recall, the amount we came up with was $10. And it didn't take away anything from Parks Canada. I mean, you know, it didn't lessen the amount that they were taking in. It kind of added to what the hikers were paying. And so we did that. We put that into effect. I do not recall that it had any impact on the number of people hiking the trail. You know, there are some local people that hike the Chilkoot Trail, obviously, but a lot of people are coming from a really long ways to hike the Chilkoot Trail, and they're spending a lot of money to get there. And I don't think an additional $10 is going to make or break it for most people. So that was something that, you know, honestly, if Rob Arnberger as regional director was not so intent on having that happen, I probably just would have let it be, quite frankly. But he did want to have it happen. You know, I wanted to be one of the superintendents that was helping him to accomplish the objectives that he had in mind for the parks. And And so we did that. And I actually think he was right. I do think it was the correct thing to do. You know, it wasn't any kind of statement about our relationship with Parks Canada, which was fabulous. And, you know, the ability to work with Parks Canada was really one of the highlights of my whole experience there. But in terms of us getting some revenue from the trail, yeah, I think it was the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And what about the historic building restoration and archaeology work? Was that all completed by the time you got there?
Along the trail, you mean?
No, in town, in the historic district.
Well, restoration and archaeology. You know, there was archaeology going on along the trail.
Okay.
And I remember we would, you know, we'd hire archaeologists. We kind of had what we call a spike camp that we would set up kind of near the base of the Chilkoot Pass. And we would have archaeologists that were, you know, basically up there for most of the summer doing archaeology work. You know, I don't recall there being a lot of archaeology in town at that time, because I think most of that had been done.
Right.
And the restoration, for the most part, was done. What really happened in terms of the historic buildings in Skagway that was significant was that during the time that I was there, pretty much all of the historic leases on those buildings rolled over. And so this would have been, you know, the early 2000s. So let's say, I think most of them had originally been 15-year leases. So they dated back to the mid-1980s. And in the mid-1980s, there was some cruise ship traffic coming to Skagway, but it was nothing like what it became. And so the cost of those leases was pretty insignificant back in the mid-80s. But in the early 2000s, when we rolled all those over, the lease prices just skyrocketed up. And that was kind of anticipated. You know, it was just, it was the market. You know, the market had changed dramatically. You know, I remember Jeff Brady, who ran the Skagway News at the time, and they were a lessee. They operated out of one of our historic buildings. And I remember Jeff saying, you know, if he could have anticipated what was going to happen in Skagway, he would have wanted more than a 15-year lease.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the change was significant. But again, that brought in a lot of revenue. We were, as I recall, by the time I left there, our annual revenue from those historic leases was about $500,000. And that was all money that the park kept. You know, what the issue developed into was, we need to spend this. And, you know, that was one of the challenges that I had with the various chiefs of maintenance that worked for me there, was that over time, you know, that money began to build up more and more. And so we needed to have sort of a maintenance plan that, you know, spended out money that we were taking in. Because we couldn't just keep sitting on it. That wasn't ever the intent. And the purpose of the historic leasing law that allowed this to happen was that you could keep the money because it would be reinvested in the maintenance and preservation of the buildings. So it was a great thing to have, but it kind of changed the whole dynamics, where suddenly we had so much money that we had to be much more focused on how we were spending it. But between that, you know, that $2 per person fee in DAI for the commercial operators, the Chilkoot Trail hiking fee, rolling over those historic leases during the time I was there, that was huge. I mean, it changed the whole revenue picture for that park. And, you know, that was something that I felt very proud of, because I felt like I managed that well, and I managed that to the benefit of that park, and I'm quite sure they're still experiencing the benefits of all of that today. So that was all really big stuff for the park financially.
Was there pushback from the community or the business owners for the leaseback program, and why you had to raise the rates? Couldn't you have just left it the way it was?
We really couldn't have. because again, it was based on appraisals and you know comparability with what other people were paying. And it, you know, when you have a lease with somebody, it's sort of like having a contract. And you know, when the lease ends, it ends, and so you know you've got to renew it with something new. And so I think everybody, I mean, like I mentioned, Jeff Brady made that point. But I think even he understood that the market had changed. And a lot of our lessees, for better or for worse, they became companies that were doing business with cruise ship passengers. And they had money. You know, Alaska Fur Gallery, I think was one. There were a couple of jewelry shops. You know, I think these places thought it was worth their while to pay money there to be able to do business in that location. And it was a pretty prime location. So, you know, was there any kind of pushback or dissatisfaction? I'm sure there was. But, you know, I think people really kind of understood what was going on there. And we had great guidance. Kevin Apgar was the regional concessions guy in Anchorage at that time. And Kevin was extremely helpful. And Reed McCluskey, who was the chief ranger at that time, he did a lot of the legwork on how those lease documents were drafted up and, you know, making sure that we were dotting all of our I's and crossing our T's. And yeah, it all, you know, it would definitely was a change, but, you know, I think it was a better change for the park in terms of the financial position.
But I think it was, yeah, the community feeling like, what's the Park Service doing making money? That the Park Service is not supposed to be getting revenue as a federal agency. Was there a feeling about that?
I don't recall that. I don't recall that. You know, what I recall, quite frankly, is that the business environment in Skagway was the most cutthroat business environment that I have ever observed in and around any national park area. And I think it was basically because you had business owners that were more or less doing a 12-month business during a four-month season. And so little things mattered in terms of revenue. And there was a lot of competition between the retailers about, you know, who could carry what. And people saying, you know what, I am the biggest buyer of that product. And if you try to carry it to, then I'm going to tell the wholesaler not to sell it to you. You know, it was a rough and tumble business environment. And, you know, in that kind of environment, I don't think people really felt that what the National Park Service was doing was even, it was almost in a separate world. And to the extent that it wasn't in a separate world, I think people would have just kind of felt like, well, you know, this is, they're just part of how it works here. So no, I don't ever remember any pushback about that. You know, in a more general sense, I could see somebody saying, well, is the Park Service sort of playing into the over-commercialization of Skagway? And I would hear that from time to time. And I would mostly hear that from Park Service employees, you know, not necessarily so much the people that were working at Klondike Gold Rush at that time, but, you know, maybe people in the regional office or maybe people that had worked at the park in the past and kind of knew what it had been. And there was just kind of a general lament about how commercial Skagway had gotten. And so, yeah, you know, there might have been a little bit of dissatisfaction with the Park Service role in that commercialization. But even there, I think most people that were concerned about excessive commercialization didn't pin that on the Park Service. You know, they saw that more as a result of the cruise ship industry and you know, the power that they had. But that's a challenge. You know, that was definitely a challenge.
Did you feel like it was getting overly commercialized?
I did. Yes, I did. And, you know, I felt that way increasingly during the time that I was there. And I, you know, putting myself in their shoes, I can see where the city council members would have been under a lot of pressure to try to accommodate this business activity. You know, there were some big players there that were spending a lot of money and were used to kind of getting what they wanted. And I think it would have been hard for, you know, any locally elected official to really stand up to that. But I remember being at a city council meeting where I was speaking. I don't remember exactly what the issue was, but I remember saying, don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And I said, the goose that laid the golden egg here is the historic character of Skagway, Alaska. And if you diminish that to the point where that's not visible anymore, then you have basically given away your biggest drawing card. And, you know, I don't know that people were really receptive to that. And, the example of how that kind of could go off course has to do with that ice house, which, as I understand it, is, I think it's still perched there somewhere on the Morehouse grounds.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, that thing was, well, let's see, I think it was kind of sort of across the street from the Morehouse, basically.
Originally?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Or maybe it was down another block towards the water. I'm not remembering for sure right now. But somebody came in and wanted to do kind of a big redevelopment of the buildings that were facing out onto Broadway there. And as a part of the redevelopment, they wanted to create more parking behind the building. And so in their mind, that was going to necessitate something happening with the ice house that,
right.
You know, it couldn't stay where it was. Well, I found this to be hugely frustrating because to me, they could have changed their design for the parking lot. I mean, it
right.
would not have really required that much of them. Maybe they could have parked fewer vehicles in there, but they could have just left the ice house where it was. And, you know, I had spent a long time saying, we're not going to move it. You know, I had really stuck with that position because I didn't want people to think that that was the easy out for them. You know, I wanted them to figure out another solution to the ice house
the
issue.
The Park Service already owned that building at
we
this
did.
Point. Yeah.
We did, yes. You know, it was in a state of relative disrepair. It was more or less kind of storage, if you could call it that. There was just kind of stuff that was stuck in there. It wasn't restored. It wasn't being used for any particular purpose. But it was there in its original location, and it was a historic Skagway building. And it ultimately became clear that this developer wasn't going to back down, and they were not going to change their plans. And I remember one day, you know, we were having a meeting, and I was kind of saying, well, you know, even if we did want to move it, I mean, how would we pay for it? And Evelyn Meyer, who was there for many, many years, retired a few years ago, she was kind of our budget analyst, and Evelyn said, well, you could pay to move it with historic leasing money. And I'm like, wow, you know, that never occurred to me. So at the end of the day, that's what we did. And my recollection is it was not cheap. I think it was like $90,000 or something to move that building. I could be wrong. But it cost quite a bit of money. And I hated to do it. It was happening right at the end of my tenure there. And I thought, this is such a horrible outcome. But the only other option was the building was going to go down. And so it kind of seemed like this was really the only recourse at that point. So yeah, that was frustrating.
And then do those funds also go into helping restore the building, or that's a separate pot of money, restoration funds?
No, they did. And you know, that's really what the money fundamentally was for. And that was what I was talking about earlier, that it, you know, it more and more became a game of coming up with there's a name for the plan that I'm not remembering right now, but it was sort of like an ongoing maintenance plan for all of our historic buildings. And we would say, you know, each year we're going to spend X amount of money doing these things on these buildings. Mm-hmm. And to kind of have a list of projects lined out so that you had something to spend the money on.
Right.
Because we didn't want to just continue to accumulate it.
Right. But I was thinking like the bigger whole, if you had a whole building, whether it's the Ice House or the YMCA Meyer building.
Right.
Or, it was the Mascot or the Pantheon. Those got restored from some pot of money. But I'm thinking that's different than the leaseback pot.
I see what you're saying.
Those were historic restoration funds?
Yeah. I think initially they were getting specific money for that restoration work. And, like I said, most of that was done before
right.
I got
right.
there. I don't recall for sure how it was done, but I think they were, sometimes just getting add-ons, budget
right.
add-ons from Senator Stevens, like, oh, okay, we'll give you this amount to do this building. So it was kind of like an addition to the park's basic budget is what my recollection
mm-hmm.
would be.
Another question I had on the lease program is you said, that rollover and you had to increase the rates and so people had to apply. How did you decide who gets a lease for building A and who gets it for building B?
It was a competitive process. You had to advertise all of them. You had to accept proposals. You had to evaluate the proposals. It was really kind of like how we handle concession operations in the Park Service. It's a competitive process, and you kind of look at the proposal. You look at what the person is offering. You look at their financials to kind of try to make some determination about the likelihood that they can actually run a viable business in that location. In the case of these buildings, certainly a lot of it had to do with how they proposed to protect the building and protect its historic character. And there were certain things in the solicitation that we put out that kind of dictated that you can't make certain changes. That was clarified. So, we wanted to see how people responded to that and get some level of comfort that they weren't going to come in and, want to tear out the interior of the building or something.
So it wasn't like low bid wins the contract?
No. It was, I think if anything, it was probably more like high bid, would have. But I don't think it was totally bid related. I think it had to do with the complete package of, what they proposed to pay. And I think there was kind of a minimum threshold that they had to agree to pay.
Right.
So that I think was pretty much spelled out up front. I think it was more to do with how would they preserve and protect the building. That had a lot to do with it. And could they, did their financials really indicate a pretty good expectation of them being able to be successful there? Because you didn't want to have somebody come in and go belly up in a couple of years and, then have to go through the
right.
whole thing all over again.
And was the issue of a local business versus a business coming in from outside, was that a factor in the decision-making process?
Not that I really recall. Did we want to have Jeff Brady and the Skagway News stay as a lessee? Yes, we did. There was no question about that. I'm trying to remember the woman's name. There was a little building that was kind of on the alley between our headquarters building and Jeff Brady's building called mm-hmm. Miss Kitty's Buttonhole.
Yeah.
And Jan, I think her... No, it
well,
wasn't...
Jan is
it
the...
It wasn't Jan Rentmore.
No, she's the Red Onion. Sue Rapley?
Sue Rapley. Thank you. And, I don't remember all the, dynamic that went down there. But Sue was, it was a smaller building. She was a smaller operation. Without recalling all the details, I'm sure she would have been more price sensitive. in terms of her ability to pay more for the lease. And I don't really remember how that played out. I don't recall whether she continued on as a lessee after it rolled over, or whether she got out of it at that point. You know, I know at some point she did get out of it, but I don't remember exactly, you know, whether that happened when I was there or whether it happened later.
But you remember her having issues with the fees? Or
I don't specifically remember it, but I could see where she would.
Okay.
I could definitely see where she would. And, it was a bit of a dilemma, just because you got these big kind of conglomerates that followed the cruise ships around, whether they were in Alaska or the Caribbean or whatever. And so, yeah, you did have local folks that were competing with those people, and they were driving the market up, absolutely. So, you know, it was a consideration, you know, kind of in our hearts, I guess you would say. But did we actually have an ability to control, you know, who got what lease? Not exactly. You know, it wasn't like there was a local preference or something.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Because there certainly is criticism through the years that I'm sure you've heard, that, you know, there's all these outside businesses selling jewelry. It's not local products, local people.
Yes.
And so how do you respond to that criticism?
Are you asking me that? Or?
I know you're aware of the criticism.
Right.
It's a bit of a criticism of the park, because you're the...
Sure.
For your buildings, you're the lease provider.
Right.
So if someone were to make that comment, how would you respond?
Well, I would respond by saying it's a really tough issue, and it is. And I don't remember exactly, you know, how the lease documents were set up. I don't remember exactly how the solicitation was handled. So, you know, I don't recall all the details about how much flexibility we had. But I do know that just the mere fact that the lease prices had gotten so high would sort of dictate that some local people were not going to be able to do it.
Right.
And, you know, is that a good thing? You know, I guess in terms of supporting local business, it's not a great thing. You know, was it a good thing budget-wise for the park? Yes, it was. You know, it absolutely was. But, you know, could somebody with some level of legitimacy criticize the Park Service for their part in that? Yeah, I think they probably could. But again, you know, I would say we weren't the primary driver of it. You know, we were just kind of stuck in the middle of this kind of really dynamic cruise ship oriented environment. And, you know, it was tough. And, you know, we were basically, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, I know people will say, well, the Park Service has 60 million acres in Alaska or whatever, it's a big player. But, you know, in terms of budget and staffing, you know, we were a pretty small entity. And, you know, we've got all these big corporations,
yeah,
you know, that are in there doing business in Skagway. You know, you're kind of outgunned. So it was a hard situation.
Well, and as you see, you didn't have an ability to give preference for local people. It was a straight out competitive.
Not that I recall. Not that I recall.
And did you ever, in your policies, a way to say, well, this business has to have a certain Gold Rush theme, or it has to carry certain kinds of products? You couldn't dictate that.
I do think we had some control over the products that they offered, and I do think we did have some control over the, you know, the kind of thematic way that they presented themselves to the public. Certainly in terms of signage and whatnot, you know, that was huge.
Yeah,
and
the Historic District Commission was really pushing on all that.
Yes, and, you know, that was basically, as I recall, it was created as a result of the park being created there. And, the park had kind of a seat on that commission. I was very involved with it. And I think it was something to do with business of the commission that led to me, you know, getting up in front of the city council members and saying, don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So
Well, and it also about this leasing program and all that, we do have to remember that the Park Service does not own every building in downtown Skagway.
Yes.
You only had control over the buildings that you owned.
Exactly, which, you know, relative to the totality of the buildings in Skagway was a pretty small percentage. You know, I think we had some great buildings and, you know, some sort of anchor buildings. But, yeah, we did not own the majority. But, yeah, there was a whole kind of historic signing plan that we developed during the time that I was there. And a tremendous amount of effort went into that, you know, in terms of coming up with sign specifications that, you know, in some cases were actually based on historic photographs and, you know, other documentation that we had, and trying to replicate, you know, fonts and you know, sometimes replicating signs for businesses that didn't even exist anymore.
Right.
I seem to recall there was some sign that was something named Noble, you know, some product named Noble that, you know, we ended up highlighting on the side of one of the buildings there. But, yeah, you know, there was a lot of concern about appearance and presentation. And even a little bit about, you know, some wayside signage and some, you know, information about the historic character of a particular building. That was all part of the leasing program as well.
Yeah, and that applies to any building in the historic district, public or private. They have to abide by those sign and font requirements and things.
Yes, yes. You know, again, you get situations where there are waivers granted and things and so forth. And, you know, that I think that was the issue with that building that ended up impacting the ice house. It seems to me that it was going up higher, it was wider, there was something about it that was kind of in excess of what typically would have been allowed. And, you know, again, I think it was a hard call for the mayor and the city council members, but, you know, I think sometimes money talks, and I think sometimes they caved the money.
I didn't realize that waivers were an option.
Well, I think they were. I mean, I think the Historic District Commission could make recommendations, but, you know, it wasn't like they were necessarily, like, enforcing the law or anything. So some of it was just kind of goodwill, basically, in terms of people's ability to or willingness to comply.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy, forget the guy's name, Casey. I think he was a lessee, too, and he was kind of a local guy who ran a jewelry shop.
Paul McBride.
Casey McBride, thank you. Yes, yes, and he had been the chair of the Historic District Commission for a really long time, including most, if not all, the time that I was there. And, you know, I like Casey. I think he worked really hard to, you know, try to do the right thing for the Historic District. It was tough, you know, definitely a tough job.
I would assume there was a lot of pushback from business owners to not want to have to abide by all those details.
Well, I'm sure there was. And, you know, I don't remember all of that in terms of non-Park Service buildings.
Right.
But, yeah, I just know that over time there was, you know, increasing numbers of challenges going on there. The place that always got the place people were always wanting to compare Skagway to was Dawson City. And, you know, I don't know what Dawson City is like today, but back in those times, in the early 2000s, I mean, the streets weren't paved. You know, Dawson City was more remote, so just by its very nature, it was kind of more rustic. You know, it hadn't been discovered by, you know, big corporate tourism the way Skagway had. And so, you know, there were a lot of people saying, well, geez, wouldn't it be nice if Skagway could be more like Dawson City? Yeah, it would be nice. And I think in terms of historic authenticity, it probably would have been for the best. But, you know, the business environments in the two places were just so different.
Yeah, well, I drove through Silverton yesterday on my way here, and it reminded me of Skagway. It's a train from Durango. It stops. It's an old mining town. You know, it's a bit of a tourist attraction. People come in on the train. It has not been fancified in the same way that Skagway has been.
Right, right. Yes, exactly.
But it has the same kind of feel to it. So on the Historic Commission, you said, so the Park Service had a representative who actually served on the commission?
I believe that was required. I think that came out of the legislation that created Klondike Gold Rush as a National Historical Park. I believe it was 1976 that the legislation was passed, and it called for the establishment of a Historic District Commission and for a representation from the Park Service on that commission. And I think somehow that got sort of incorporated into the city government's, they established the commission.
Right.
Through their own channels in response to the Park Service legislation, and it, continued to function after that. And, I think they did a good job. I think the people on the commission, and I don't, beyond Casey, I don't remember many of them now, but, I think they were really committed to trying to do the right thing. It got increasingly challenging.
And was there a conflict of interest having a Park Service staff person on the commission?
Well, I think because it was basically legislated, there wasn't a conflict of interest. Serving on commissions and so on, usually you need to get some kind of ethics approval to do that. At that time, things were a little looser than they are now, but I'm not sure that it even would have been required, just because I think it was a legislated role for the Park Service.
So during your tenure, there was always a staff person on the commission.
Well, and I think it was me. I think after Teresa Thiebaud got there, I think she had some involvement in it, but yeah, I think it was me.
It wasn't Carl Gerke, the historian?
Not that I recall. I don't recall Carl being really involved in what the Historic District Commission did. Maybe he was, and I just, maybe I was just seeing it through my involvement, but I don't recollect that.
But you remember going to commission meetings and having
sure.
those discussions.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, shall we take a little bit of a break?
Yeah,
I could
stand to go.
Okay, I thought I'd sort of take us back to some of the management administration issues that you walked into,
right.
We started to talk about before, that it seemed like before you got there maybe were some issues within the leadership team. Oh, your vacuuming is getting louder.
Yeah.
She must be above us.
Yeah. Do you want to pause it for a minute?
So I was bringing up again this issue of the administration and the leadership team and what you inherited. And I know, I think it was before you got there, there was this evaluation report done.
Right, right.
That was before you got there.
Yes, it was.
Do you know the circumstances of what led to that?
I don't. And when you had first mentioned that, I had completely forgotten about it. And I've kind of thumbed through it a little bit. Didn't you send me a copy?
Yeah.
I
also have one here if you want to look at it.
Yeah, I haven't really read through it word for word. It does seem to me that some of it had to do with just kind of the organizational changes that I talked about,
right.
And breaking things out that had previously been under the chief ranger. Management review. I mean, I tend to look at this. Interesting, huh? Yeah, some of the people who were involved in this. Goodness gracious, Jack Burns. Yeah, I've worked with him at the Denver Service Center. I think it's the same guy. What I tend to see in this is that this is kind of probably a routine thing that they were doing when there was a change in superintendent. They were probably bringing in a team and, evaluating the operation and making some recommendations. So I think that's kind of what...
So you don't recall if this was done because regional felt like things were not working well with staff at Klondike?
I don't recall. So here's some of the Yeah, okay, interesting. I do not recall. But my guess would be that there was nothing out of the ordinary about this. I really doubt that it was being done because it was thought that there were some specific problems there that called for it. You know, like I said, I think it was probably done more as sort of a routine matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it was partly to help a new superintendent coming into the job to sort of move forward on things that the regional office felt like needed to be moved forward
on. And as you said, one of their recommendations was the creating a head of resources position, which
right.
you did implement. Were there other things that you implemented that you think that were coming out of this report?
You know, there was another thing that I looked at when you had first sent me this that I thought, well, actually, we didn't really do that. So let's see here. Recruit GS-12, Chief of Resources, yes. Yeah, April 24, 2000. So that would have been when I was there kind of in the acting capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Hire a GS-5 administrative support clerk as outlined in the report. Maybe we did that. I don't really recall. You know, that would not, you know, I'm not trying to judge things based on the grade level, but that wouldn't have been an extremely significant thing that I would have necessarily recommended. Budget computer specialist, we did do that after a little bit of drama, somebody coming and then leaving after 2 weeks.
Wow.
We ended up getting an excellent person in that position. She ultimately left the Park Service after transferring to a couple of other Park Service jobs, and that's kind of unfortunate, but that's a whole different story. So, yes. Chief Ranger position by removing the duties associated with resource management. Yeah, and they're basically saying, I guess, come up with a new position description for that.
Right, which would make sense. If you took out their supervisory role of interim staff and resources staff, you'd have to have a new job description.
Yes, yes. The new Chief of Resource Management over the first 6 months should review the recommendations associated with the historian, museum, curator, and custodial worker, so on and so forth. Okay. And, I'm sure at some level that was done. Review position descriptions, conduct desk audits on wage grade 5 maintenance worker and wage grade 3 custodial worker. I kind of remember that, but I don't remember exactly what was going on there. Hire temporary interpreters. We certainly did that. Prepare a written historic lease maintenance program. This is what I was talking about
right.
earlier, including a funding plan. It is critical. The park document the cyclic maintenance program using historic leaseback program funding in order to assure that accountability is achieved.
And so that you implemented that.
We did, but you know that would be maybe the one thing of all of those things that probably didn't come together as well as I wish it could have. I think we had a tough time of finding the right people to actually do that. And it was, kind of a complicated thing. And I just don't think we had the right people at the table during my tenure there to really get that in place the way it needed to be. And so that became, a bit of a struggle, sort of an unfulfilled expectation. I remember there was a woman who came in after I left to act for me, Nancy somebody from the regional office. You seem to be able to
That name's not a familiar name.
Yeah,
I can't pull that one out.
I can't think of Nancy's name right now. And she ultimately, she spent, 3 to 6 months there in Skagway, eventually retired from the Park Service. I don't think she ever did become a permanent full-time superintendent, as far as I know. But I remember talking to her and saying, we really do need to get that maintenance plan done. And I was told by people after I left, she really cracked the whip, trying to achieve that. And I think she ran into some of the same challenges that I did, just, having the people around the table that needed to be there in order to accomplish that goal was a bit challenging. I'm kind of guessing, I think they did ultimately get a good a really good facility manager in there who's very highly regarded. I think he's the guy who's the facility manager at Denali now. Ray somebody. I can't think of his last name. But I'm kind of guessing when he got there, they probably did get that done. It is my thought. But yeah, that of all the things on the list, that was probably the one thing that really didn't get done to the degree that we would have liked it to have.
And you mentioned that there were challenges to getting that done, getting certain people around the table or whatever. Can you expand on that?
Well, here's what I would say as a general rule. When I was there at Klondike Gold Rush, I was always amazed by the quality of the young people that we would hire. We had some extraordinarily good employees. Jim Wessel, who came in as a ranger, fabulous guy. Rose Parado, later Rose Worley, she was the one we hired into that IT budget analyst position, fabulous employee. We hired a woman named Meg Haar, who was just sensational. She came in and worked in our resource management division, went to Kenai Fjords, got a job as the chief of resource management at Pictured Rocks on the upper peninsula of Lake Michigan. And unfortunately, right after she got there, she was killed in a bicycling accident. A really, really sad thing, because she was just a wonderful human being and just such an outstanding employee. So we had great, great young people who were early in their career, didn't have kind of family encumbrances that would make it difficult for them to come to Alaska for a Park Service job. But what my observation was, when you got to the division chief level, that's where it got more challenging to get the right people into the jobs. Mm-hmm. Because I think people who have reached a point in their career where it's reasonable for them to aspire to that kind of position, well, a lot of times they're going to be old enough that they're going to have kids. They're going to have kids maybe in high school. There were certain people that maybe wouldn't have wanted their kids to go to high school in Skagway. It was a small school. I know there were even local people who had kind of lived there for a long, long time that would send their kids out of Alaska to go to high school just because they thought they'd get a better education there. In my opinion, it was hard to get people who were really, really excellent, high-performing people as division chiefs to want to come and work there. It sounds to me like maybe there's been some forward progress made in that regard. The other thing about going to Alaska kind of later in your career is that, it used to be that you didn't want to retire in Alaska because the locality thing worked against you. When you got the locality pay, but what you actually got was base pay for your regular salary. And your retirement income was going to be based on base pay. And base pay is like really low. So, base pay was being supplemented by the locality, but, it wasn't really helping you when it came to what your retirement income would be. So a lot of people late in their government careers would not want to go to Alaska. Now, that has changed now. They've changed the locality pay. I think it's a more conducive environment for people to come there and even to retire there if that's what they choose to do. So in any event, yeah, it was a tough challenge getting the right people into division chief positions. That was my experience.
Mm-hmm. And were there issues with some employees who had been there a long time and therefore they're sort of set in their ways and a new superintendent comes in and it doesn't work as well?
I don't really recall that. I did mention earlier the issue with the one employee who left when a new supervisor came along, but I didn't necessarily feel like that reflected directly on me. It was just kind of like a change. I didn't... I think maybe there were times when there were some people that reported immediately to me that I didn't feel as supported by as I would have liked to have been. That was true. But in terms of what you're describing, people who have been there for a long time, who might have had ideas about how things that ought to be done and who weren't supportive, mm-hmm. I don't really recall that.
Especially you coming in after somebody who had been superintendent for so long. I mean, superintendencies with Park Service frequently change on a regular basis,
right.
But they had somebody there for 13, 14 years. Was wondering if that made a difference to the new regime.
Yeah, no, I didn't feel that. I do remember somebody made a comment one time about, I was handling hiring very differently than Clay had, my predecessor, that, he would get people really involved in the hiring process, and it wasn't just him making a hiring decision. And I will say, at that time I was doing a lot of that kind of on my own when it came to making a hiring decision, partly because I guess I felt like it was ultimately my responsibility, and I think partly because at that time I was like, I don't want to necessarily create more work for other people. I'd like to sort of try to contain that. I think over time I've actually seen the benefit of getting people more involved and having sort of panels of people that are mm-hmm. involved in making hiring decisions and, being a little more inclusive in that regard. I do remember that comment being made. Those things are legitimate. I don't really remember as a general rule that there were people that weren't receptive to my being there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the getting that lease building maintenance plan going.
Yes.
And that you had challenges getting that off the ground. Can you talk about some of that?
Well, I think it was just having the right person in the job.
And that job meaning chief of maintenance, Jeff?
Yes, yes. I was there for a year, maybe 2 years, with one chief of maintenance. I don't recall if he retired. I think he retired. And then we hired another chief of maintenance. They were people who had experience in the Park Service, the kind of day-to-day operations stuff. I mean, that was kind of their bread and butter, and they knew that. But to kind of, ask them to sort of take it to a higher level and deal with something that was maybe a little bit outside of their comfort zone, we just didn't have the right person to do that during the time that I was there, is my recollection of it. The other thing is, like anything, it becomes a workload factor. I mean, it was going to take some effort. If I had to do it all over again, looking back on it, I think what probably would have been helpful at the time was to ask for more regional office help to do that. I think they would have had people who would have been willing and able to help, and that would have been a good thing. That's always a little challenging as a superintendent. You want to be careful about the times and the places that you ask for regional office help, because at some level you want help when you need it, but at other levels you want to sort of give the impression that you're taking care of your own issues. And if you're asking for too much help too often, that can sometimes sort of give the wrong impression. But I think in hindsight, asking for regional office help with that at the time would have been a good thing.
Well, that brings up one of my questions, which was the local versus regional relationship, good, bad. Did this example, you said, you might have wanted their help. Were there other times where they came in and wanted to do things and you were like, we don't need you, or they're interfering with local issues?
You know, for the most part, I don't remember a lot of that. I alluded to some of it when I talked about Rob Arnberger as right. regional director. I mean, he had certain things that he wanted to do, and I think in all the parks in Alaska, you know, he was kind of expecting the superintendents were going to cooperate with him and trying to get those things done. And, you know, we did that with the fee that we implemented with the Chilkoot Trail. But, you know, I'm not thinking of too many examples of that. I think the one frustration that I probably had just as a general rule dealing with our regional office is that I didn't feel like most of our people in Anchorage really understood the complexity of the operation at Klondike Gold Rush. You know, I think in Alaska, with so many big parks there, you know, the complexity of a superintendent's job and of a park operation is judged based on how many millions of acres you manage. And, you know, in Skagway, it was based more on how many hundreds of thousands or millions of visitors you have.
Right.
And it was also based on some of the things we've already talked about, your ability to operate in this really dynamic business environment, political environment, you know, really being elbow to elbow with a lot of people in that small town that you had to be able to work with and get along with. And so if you're just looking at it as, oh, well, you know, this is one of our smallest parks in Alaska, you know, a lot of times I think people wanted to put it in the same category with Sitka. I do not think there is any comparability other than the fact that Sitka and Skagway are both in Southeast Alaska. I think Skagway is a much, much more complicated operation. It certainly was at the time, and I would guess that it continues to be today. And I just never really felt like our regional office fully got it as far as what was going on in Skagway. Now, the breath of fresh air was the regional chief of maintenance who came in from Yellowstone by the name of Tim Hudson. And Tim is still working for the Park Service. I think he's worked for the Park Service for like 50 years now. And he's, as far as I know, he's the superintendent of this new national park area that got established in Maine a couple of years ago, North Woods or something like that. But Tim was a, you know, real veteran Park Service person. He instantly got what was going on in Skagway. And, you know, he told me after he got there, he said, wow, he said, you've got a lot going on here, Bruce. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, thank you for recognizing that. Because, you know, he was one of the few people who I thought really sort of did see all the ins and outs of what goes on there. But I'm sorry, I'm kind of probably deviating.
No, that's, you're answering it exactly what I was asking, which was the local versus regional relationship and how that worked or didn't work and changed over time and things. So that answered that. I was thinking that, you know, Klondike, you say that wasn't really very well understood. I wonder if that's partially because it was historic. As you said, it was in this town and it's historic, and most other Alaska national parks tend to be more, you know, wild lands, natural history kind of parks.
I think that's true. I really think that's true. I think that had a tremendous amount to do with it. And I think that was also the same reason why they tended to lump Klondike Gold Rush in with Sitka.
Right.
Because they thought, oh, well, they're both historical parks. It's kind of the same thing. Well, not exactly. Sitka, for one thing, just didn't have nearly the cruise ship traffic that Skagway had. But I think there were other differences as well. You know, I recall one of the things I'm thinking more about kind of regional office relationships. One of the things that was always really frustrating to me and really hard to understand was the land selection process in Alaska. And, you know, there was municipal land selections that had taken place within the boundaries of Klondike Gold Rush. So the city of Skagway actually owned land within the park boundaries out in Dyea. And they also owned a fairly sizable chunk of land, you know, way up the Chilkoot Trail. It was actually up above Sheep Camp campground. It was between Sheep Camp and the Chilkoot Pass.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never really got a clear answer about, well, you know, why did Skagway even want that? But, you know, what I think it was is it was like it was an investment, basically. You know, if they had that land, well, at some point, you know, maybe there's something they would want to do to develop it, or maybe the Park Service would buy it from them for a ton of money. So, you know, it was sort of an investment. But what I always thought was really unusual during the time that I was there was that the National Park Service was a minority landowner within our own boundaries.
Hmm.
We did not own the majority of the land within our boundaries.
Well, and I know the Chilkoot Trail is just a corridor.
It's just a corridor.
You
now
own the whole area around it.
Yes, yes. Now, we did make some headway on that because there was a piece of legislation that went through, I think before I got to Alaska, but it involved Glacier Bay. And Glacier Bay had a piece of land, I believe it was called Falls Creek, that was taken out of wilderness status. So it was actually kind of a big deal. But the reason it was taken out of wilderness status was because they wanted to put in a hydroelectric power plant there to provide power for Gustavus. And I think they have ultimately done that. And as a part of the legislation, there was a requirement that in compensation for the Park Service giving up this land, having it taken out of wilderness status, the state of Alaska would give land to the Park Service. And one place that they could do that under this legislation was, I think it was called Long Lake at Wrangell St. Elias. And another place that they could do it was along the Chilkoot Trail at Klondike Gold Rush. And, you know, I worked a lot with Chuck Gilbert, who was the lands program coordinator in the regional office for many, many, many years. I liked Chuck a lot. I told Chuck many times, I said, geez, Chuck, you know, I really feel bad possibly being a beneficiary of this legislation because it just seems wrong to me that they're taking land out of wilderness status at Glacier Bay. And he was always, you know, very supportive and saying, you know, Bruce, you didn't create that. You know, that's not your responsibility. You know, don't get too hung up on that. But I do remember having a meeting one time with Marsha Blazak, who I think at that time was the deputy regional director, and Gary Candelaria, who at that time was the superintendent of Wrangell St. Elias, and myself, to talk about, you know, what were the replacement lands going to be. And I really was grateful to Gary, because Gary basically said, you know, we got 13 million acres at Wrangell St. Elias. It's not going to kill us if we don't have Long Lake. You know, it would be fine for that to go to Klondike Gold Rush. And that's what I'd been advocating for a long time, so I really appreciated him saying that. That didn't all totally come to pass during my tenure there, but not long after I left, we did acquire, you know, I think a couple of thousand additional acres along Chilkoot Trail that had previously been owned by the state of Alaska. So that was a big deal. But I'm guessing even today, we are still minority landowners within the boundaries of Klondike Gold Rush. And I thought it was wrong. I had, at Harper's Ferry, I had gotten to know the guy who was a superintendent of Antietam really well. John Howard was his name. John was a really creative guy, somebody who I probably didn't get as much credit for the good things that he did that as he actually deserved. But as I recall, he had worked a lot with the Mellon Foundation to get money to acquire property at Antietam. And I had talked to John and had gotten some information about the Mellon Foundation and who the contact people were and so on and so forth. And I might have even had some conversations with people at the Mellon Foundation. And I kind of thought, you know, here is kind of an iconic, historic place in Alaska. And wouldn't the Mellon Foundation potentially have a really strong interest in trying to help the Park Service acquire this land? And I got to talking about that in a meeting one time with Rob Arnberger when he was regional director, and Marcia Blazak when she was the deputy regional director. And Marcia, in particular, said, you know, Bruce, I don't think you should be working with the Mellon Foundation to try to acquire this land. If we were going to work with the Mellon Foundation at all in Alaska, I'm not sure the Klondike Gold Rush is the place that we'd want them to focus their efforts. And I didn't say anything. I mean, these were people that I reported to, but I just thought, holy smokes. It wasn't like I was asking them to do any work.
Right.
And it just seemed to me that it was such an obvious, potential benefit for Klondike Gold Rush. And they just completely shut me down. And, you know, that was getting towards the tail end of my time there. And I was kind of getting to a place where I'm feeling like, well, if you're not letting me work on this, then what else can I do here? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it kind of got me to a place of starting to think, maybe my long-term future is not here. Although it was painful because I loved Alaska. I loved Klondike Gold Rush. I loved Alaska in general. I think in a perfect world, I would have spent my whole career in Alaska. It was really hard to leave, really hard. But, I was just getting to a point where I was feeling like, I'm not getting the support I need to do the things that I think this park needs to do.
Mm-hmm. And so, what was I going to say about... So that land issue, that's a legacy of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act?
Yes.
But wouldn't the municipality, they had the land already before Anilka?
No, they didn't. And, it would have been, I think, kind of undifferentiated federal land before Anilka, and then it became Park Service land, and then municipalities got to make their selections.
I didn't think they could select within what was already selected as federal land. That's why I was thinking they had it first, and the Fed had to select around it.
Well,
I don't remember.
I'd like to understand more about that. actually, in retirement, I might just go back and work on that because I've thought about writing several things that would factor into, and I would like to understand it more. Klondike Gold Rush was not an Anilka park. It
was pre-Anilka.
It predated Anilka. There were a couple of provisions in Anilka that applied directly to Klondike Gold Rush, but for the most part, we were not dealing with Anilka on a daily basis like some of the Anilka parks did. So I was never as familiar with all the provisions of Anilka as I would have liked to have been at the time, but... all I know is they did select land within federal boundaries at Klondike Gold Rush.
Okay.
That did happen.
Okay. That's a new one on me.
Yeah.
So we were sort of talking about, the division chiefs and leadership and your management style. So when you got there, how were those positions communicating and working with each other and then with their respective staffs?
I think there was definitely friction at the management team level, absolutely. It's kind of hard to even describe exactly where all of it was coming from. The one division chief that I talked about feeling mm-hmm. badly about having to put him in a different position and so on, in that particular situation, I just don't think there was respect there. I think people...
staff?
And peers.
Okay.
I think the peers saw, wow, there's a lot of stuff that's not getting done. But there were other aspects of it that I think were a little more personal. People that were, for whatever reason, they were just not getting along. And that was unfortunate. There could have been some gender issues there or some perceived gender issues. I can't really... and I think some of it was just style. I think there were some people that, didn't like other people's styles of operating. And so it made it challenging. When you're a superintendent of a park, what you fundamentally want is for people to get along. But if they don't, you can't wave a magic wand and make that happen. You can do, leadership team retreats and have people come in and, make recommendations about how you can work more effectively together and so on and so forth. And, we did some of that during the time I was there. I've done it subsequently at other places that I've been. But at the end of the day, people really have to make an individual decision that they're going to do something different to work better with their peers. And I didn't feel like we quite overcame all that, during the time I was there. And that was frustrating.
So those retreats, was there any progress made after those? Or did the participants have to all say, we'll be nice to each other now?
I'm sure there were those kind of pledges that were made. I remember we brought in kind of a facilitator, I think from Anchorage, to work with us. And I remember we had a retreat out in Dai. And, mm-hmm. This would have been, I'm going to say 2003. I'd probably been there for a while that time. As I recollect, we all went through the Myers-Briggs process, mm-hmm. and so on. And I remember the facilitator kind of saying, I hope it was a joke. It really actually was not a good thing to say out loud. But I remember the facilitator saying, looking at each of your individual personality profiles, it's kind of amazing that you're even able to work together as well as you do.
Yeah, that's not very helpful.
Yeah, it was not a constructive thing to say. It was the kind of thing that you could certainly think, but you shouldn't have verbalized it. And she did verbalize it. As I recall, it was to the whole group, although I don't really remember exactly when and how it came up. But I just think there were issues there that never really got totally resolved. I'm sure people said, we're going to work together to try to do better and so on and so forth. But I just don't think it really got resolved to the degree that I would have liked to have seen it.
And you gave the example of that one position that you moved around. Were there other things that you tried to implement to improve the communication and morale?
Well, at that time we weren't doing the employee viewpoint survey and so on. The stuff that we kind of did to try to deal with morale, I think, was sort of the garden variety things that you do. You have social get-togethers and, parties for this reason and that reason and potlucks and things like that. In those kind of environments, everything was pretty good. I think on a, on kind of a personal level, I think people could sort of put their differences aside and do fine. It was more in the work environment that you couldn't overcome those things. And I think you alluded to this in some of the emails that you sent. There was somebody at some point who, filed some kind of a complaint against me or something. And I don't remember exactly even what the nature of it was. But the challenge with this particular employee is that they wanted to be paid more. And they were viewing me as an obstruction to having that happen. Well, Marsha Blazak, who had been around the regional office for a number of years and who ultimately became regional director, she wasn't going to let this person get a pay increase in a million years. I mean, it just wasn't happening. So it almost didn't really matter what I thought, because when it got to Marsha's level, wasn't going to go forward. And so I never actually told that to this employee, because I basically felt like it would be creating an issue between that employee and some other person, and I didn't want to, you know, add to the difficulty of the situation. So I just kind of, you know, did the best that I could to take my own responsibility for that. And the employee, I think, as time went by, became increasingly dissatisfied that they were not getting a pay increase. And I think they saw the remedy for that to come after me. And, you know, initially, I think there was, you know, some suggestion that it was really bigger than just this particular employee, that it extended further in the work group than just that person. But the regional office ultimately decided that it was just kind of between me and that employee, or at least that's how we were going to approach it. And I actually think that was the right decision. And so they sent over like a conflict mediator to sit down and work with that employee. And I, you know, I honestly thought so much of it was related to that person wanting more money, and that, you know, that was really the root of it. But we did talk about some things that, you know, we could do to work together more effectively. We ultimately signed an agreement to solidify our commitment to working more effectively together. I took it all really hard. You know, if that kind of thing were to happen today, I would take it hard, but I wouldn't take it as hard, because I've seen how things go in the workplace. And I better understand that even when people are doing their very best to get the right outcome, sometimes people just aren't happy. That happens. It's just kind of the nature of things. At the time, I kind of felt like, wow, you know, I've been here, I've poured my heart and soul into this job, and I really had. And I felt like, you know, now somebody's sort of trying to victimize me for all the effort that I put into it. So I really took it hard. It was a difficult thing for me. Not too long after that, the employee got another job. And they actually did get a grade increase, so they got the promotion that they wanted. We happened to be on annual leave when I got a call to do a reference check on that employee. And so my wife overheard it. You know, I'm talking to the person on the cell phone. And we finished the call, and my wife said, "You lied." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, you said all these things about this person that aren't true." And I said, I was trying to emphasize the positive, you know, I will admit that. But I said, you know, the reality of it is this person and I are not getting along. Now, what am I going to do? You know, scuttle their chances for getting another job? Right. So, you know, ultimately that person moved on. Hopefully they were happier, you know, wherever they ended up. But that was definitely a difficult situation for me, for sure.
Well, and it's interesting you bring up that being a new superintendent and kind of walking into this bit of a quagmire of personalities and the leadership issues, that must have been challenging.
Well, it was. And, you know, by the same token, you know, if I'm looking at it objectively, it might have been challenging for everybody else as well. You know, it was challenging for me, but, you know, I was a new superintendent. And so did I have it all figured out? No, I didn't. And, you know, the reason I know that is because I've been doing it for 19 years now, and I still don't have it all figured out. You know, it's complicated work, but, yeah. I would like to think I've gotten better over the years. And, you know, was I making some rookie mistakes? Maybe. You know, that's a possibility. But, you know, I always feel like in the workplace, just like in families, just like in human relations, you know, fundamentally, there's got to be a level of forgiveness towards each other. I mean, things are not always going to go exactly the way you want them to. And, you know, at some level, you've got to accept that and come to work the next day and roll up your sleeve and get back to work. And yeah, there wasn't as much of that kind of level of forgiveness going on there as I think would have been helpful for everybody involved.
And do you see how your management style was sort of implemented there? I don't know if you can describe your management style.
Well, you know, what I would like to think and what I've always told people is that I try to be inclusive, you know, and I try to be more of what I understand is kind of the, you know, the Japanese corporate management model of, you know, letting the employees have a voice and not making autocratic decisions. And, you know, that's the way I've attempted to operate. You know, I am by no means the sort of person who's going to come in and say, look, you need to do this, this, and this, and have it done by noon tomorrow. You know, that's just not my style. So, you know, I try to work with people where they're at and support them in trying to do the things that need to be done. You know, that's how I feel I'm operating. Now, you know, maybe other people see my style a little differently than how I see it. I don't know. I can't speak for how somebody else might see it. But I think that was another reason why I took some of these things sort of hard, because I thought, geez, folks, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, keep you under my boot heel. You know, I'm really trying to allow you to blossom and flourish in your job. And, you know, let's get a little, thankfulness and a little bit of, you know, mutual support for that. And, you know, I didn't feel like there was as much of that as I would have liked to have seen there.
Did you have situations where an employee came to you with complaints about their supervisor or their work situation?
You know, I don't remember that so much, other than that one situation that I already mentioned, right, about the employee who left.
Right.
You know, I don't. Well, and, you know, and I guess I remember it a little bit in terms of the one person that I had to reassign,
right,
you know, who ultimately left and got another job. I did have some people come to me and say, you know, if I've got to keep working for this person, I don't think I can stay here. So, you know, I did have some things like that. It wasn't commonplace. And in my experience, that doesn't happen very often. That's a really dangerous thing to do. If you go to the head of your supervisor and go to your supervisor's supervisor and say, you know, that person is jerking me around, you're taking a real chance. You might get what you're hoping for, but you might not. So a lot of people don't want to take that risk, I don't think.
Even if it's your supervisor that you have problems with? So who are you supposed to go to?
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. And, you know, what I've done, I don't remember whether I did it at Klondike Gold Rush or not, but what I've subsequently done is, you know, I've got a published open door policy, and I put it out in writing. You know, I renew it from time to time. And I basically say, you know, the objective is to work out issues with your own supervisor when issues come up. But if you're not able to work them out with your own supervisor, come and talk to me. And people do that sometimes. But again, you know, when they do, I usually have a tremendous amount of admiration for the people, because it's a hard thing to do. You know, it generally has to have gotten to a point where somebody's really, really unhappy about something before they take it to that level. And, you know, other than the instances that I'm already remembering, I'm not really remembering other examples of that happening at Klondike Gold Rush.
But you feel there was some improvement with the leadership team and people getting along while you were there?
Well, as a general rule, I do. You know, the one employee I mentioned who wanted a pay increase, got another job, got a pay increase, moved on. Now, that happened fairly soon before I left, so I wasn't really around to kind of, you know, reap the benefits of that. But I think it was a positive thing for the park, because I was not the only one that this employee did not get along with. So I think it was a good thing. You know, the person I mentioned who had to be reassigned and ultimately left, the person that I hired to replace that person was really good, and I think came in and brought some good things to the park, and was somebody who kind of operated in a, you know, non-confrontational manner and fit in well with other people on the management team. So, I think we did make some positive changes. It just, I guess you might say through attrition. But it wasn't necessarily all the way to the point where you would have looked at it and said, this is ideal.
Right. Well, you say that example of one person you hired that it worked really well. Were there people that got hired that it added to problems or created new problems that didn't work out as well?
Well, how to answer that question? You got to look at sort of the totality of things, and you can zero in on something and kind of miss the bigger picture sometimes. The person who I hired as a chief of resource management, I mean, I think it was friction there that caused this one person to resign from the Park Service. Was some of that coming, was some of the problems that led to that coming from the person that I hired? Maybe. That's entirely possible. On the other hand, that person that I hired had a lot of connections with, I'm blanking on the name right now, and I shouldn't be, but the folks who were the owners of the National Bank of Alaska.
The Rasmussens.
And, ultimately, although it didn't totally come to fruition on my watch, I think those connections were really instrumental in getting the Rapuzzi collection into Park Service ownership. So, some of this stuff, you got to, take the whole package. And you can zero in on something and say, well, I wish this person was nicer to that person or whatever. Yes, you do wish those things. But, you kind of got to look at the whole package.
So in that case, you think in the big picture, that person was effective in accomplishing the goals you had hoped would be accomplished?
Well, yes and no. Certainly as far as the Rapuzzi collection was concerned, absolutely. Now, that person kind of came out of a cultural resources background like I did. Mm-hmm. So I think you'd probably say I had expectations for somebody in that position that might have been a little greater than I had for other people in other division chief positions, because I knew more about what that person was doing.
Right.
And so, I might have been a little dissatisfied about some things that didn't happen exactly the way that I would have liked them to have happened. And, that's part of a learning experience and the growth process you have to go through being a superintendent as well. Everybody comes out of their own background. They've got their own specialty area. But at some level, you got to realize, you just can't engage in everything. You've got to kind of pick your battles because there's only so much you can do as one person. So, I think even where that person was concerned, I think in general I was accepting of what that person brought to the table. Was everybody else accepting of it? And was that a good fit into the personnel chemistry at the management team level? Well, that becomes a little more problematic. Maybe it wasn't exactly the best fit for the work group. So those are the kind of things you always have to kind of, hiring people is it's challenging business.
Yeah, it's very difficult, definitely. Speaking about cultural resources, this is a question that the Klondike wanted me to ask about is if you remember a historic preservation workshop that was held in Skagway.
I do. And I've actually, sometime during the process of emailing back mm-hmm. and forth with you about this interview, I did get on the phone and talk to Carl Gerke, and mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about that as well. That was a sensationally successful thing, in my opinion. I had the benefit of having started my career in the Washington office of the National Park Service where, you know, most of the brain power for the Cultural Resources Program of the National Park Service was located. So I knew a lot of people that really knew their stuff and who were influential kind of at a national level, I guess you'd have to say. And so at some point it occurred to me, well, you know, I know these people. I ought to try to get some of them here. And so I did. And we brought a number of people there. You know, some of them were Park Service people. Some of them were people like, as I recall, Judy Bittner, who was and I think still is the Alaska State Historic Preservation Officer. And, you know, I think really highly of Judy and always worked really well with her. And, you know, I think we put on a really sensational conference. And, you know, I think it provided a lot of good information. And a lot of it, I think, was kind of growing out of what I talked about earlier. It was my concern that Skagway was killing the goose that laid the golden egg, which was, right. You know, its historic character. And so I think we brought in some really good people to talk about, now these are the things that really need to be considered in preserving your historic character and how you go about doing that and, you know, where the money is to help achieve those goals and so on and so forth. So I thought it went really well. The one thing that I sort of remember in hindsight was that we had a lot of park employees there at that conference who I think benefited from it, and that was a good thing. I really wish we would have had more people from the community. And I remember there was one person from the community, Charlotte Jewell, who at the time ran Jewell Gardens right. and other things. And, you know, she participated in the conference, and I remember her saying at one point, well, geez, you know, why didn't you do more to advertise this? And I was kind of like, oh, goodness gracious. I mean, you know, I felt like we had really bent over backwards to advertise it. And, you know, my frustration was that we didn't have kind of more receptivity. Mm-hmm. You know, I was happy that she showed up and found it to be beneficial. And I'm sure there were others, too, in the community. But, you know, part of my recollection is that I really wish there would have been more of a turnout from the locals, because I just felt like there was so much good information and I would have liked to have seen it, you know, spread even widely, more widely.
There are lots of local building owners who, if you're talking about preserving historic buildings, might have benefited from it, more
exactly.
information.
And I do think there were some. Virginia Long, the Portland House, I think Virginia's still in Skagway.
Yep.
I believe
yep.
she was there. Virginia and I were always very friendly, and her significant other, Howard, you know, I liked them a lot. I think she was there. I'm sure there were some other people
right.
from the community.
Do you remember what year that workshop
you
was?
You know, I'm going to guess, you know, again, it was probably towards the tail end of my time there. It probably would have been 2003.
Okay. Well, that's good to help explain it, because I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. It because I left around Memorial Day of 2004, so the season was really kind of just kicking off at that point.
Right.
So it must have been 2003 that happened, would be my guess.
Okay. And how much interaction was there with the Seattle unit of Klondike while you were there?
Good question. So Seattle, well, it's hard to even know where to jump in to start answering that question. You know, I think originally when Klondike Gold Rush was created through this legislation in 1976, I think it was viewed that Seattle and Skagway would be very connected and that, you know, they would operate very closely in tandem.
Mm-hmm.
What changed after that with ANILCA and so on was that they eventually opened a regional office in Anchorage. When Skagway, when Klondike Gold Rush was first created, it was all part of the Pacific Northwest region that was managed out of Seattle.
Okay.
And so it was kind of under one regional director management structure. And so I think there was kind of a greater potential at the beginning that it all could have held together like I think it was intended to legislatively.
Mm-hmm.
But when Alaska became a separate region, I think both parks started to migrate apart. And there was kind of a similar situation, not exactly similar, but there was a superintendent when I got to Skagway who had been at the Seattle unit of Klondike Gold Rush for a really, really long time. And I didn't really know him well, but my sense of him and what I heard from other people was that he was not bringing a lot to the table. You know, he just wasn't highly motivated. He wasn't doing a lot. There just wasn't a lot going on there. And, you know, for a long time, there was a regional office in Seattle, and then that all got sort of consolidated in San Francisco. But even then, there was a big kind of a support office presence in Seattle. So the regional office and then later the support office, I think, really ended up controlling Klondike Gold Rush Seattle. And I think they had certain sort of visions for that area that were kind of in the category of a welcome center for Seattle. Yes, it did have something to do with the Gold Rush and so on and so forth. But, you know, I don't think there was as much joint management as there could have been. The superintendent that I was referring to ultimately ended up, I think, retiring. And then they did a management review, kind of like that report right. that we talked about earlier. Well, they did a similar thing at Klondike Seattle. And I got asked to be a part of the review team. And so I went down and participated in that. And they were getting ready to, they had just acquired the Cadillac building in Seattle, and they were getting ready to move their headquarters into that.
Right.
And the building at that time was, you know, kind of unrestored. It was really in almost kind of ruinous condition. But they were working on that. They had an acting superintendent at the time, Stephanie Toothman, who was like the regional chief of cultural resources in the Pacific West region, ultimately became the Park Service chief of cultural resources for the entire agency, was really somebody who was a commanding presence, and she had a lot of influence over Klondike Seattle. And I just, you know, I felt like at the time that I left Skagway, that, you know, there continued to be an unfulfilled potential for more collaboration between those two parks than what had ever actually been achieved.
Yeah.
Now, you know, whether that's kind of progressed in a more, you know, collaborative direction since then, I don't really know.
Yeah. And I was wondering if at the superintendent level, the connections might have been different than, you know, at the staff level.
Well, I do... You know, I vaguely recall that it seems to me I was the instigator of this, or at least I want to give myself credit for it anyway. I think we started having conference calls between Klondike Seattle, Klondike Skagway, and I believe also Parks Canada. And I think we were trying to, you know, talk, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 times a year, and just, you know, see if we could do more to get on the same page. And I, you know, I think maybe there was a little bit of headway. As I recollect, initially, the superintendent at Klondike Seattle was the one I mentioned who was not overly enthusiastic. And so, you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on. But it did seem like, you know, if that had continued into the future long enough under new leadership there at Klondike Seattle, I think there was a potential for more collaboration.
And would the collaboration have been on interpretive and educational programming? Or?
Yeah, kind of all of that stuff. And, you know, I think in general, at least at the beginning, it was more kind of like just updates. Like, well, these are the things we're working on. Maybe you would want to be aware of this. And, you know, just trying to sort of get everybody on the same page. But, yeah, the collaboration, I think, was very much intended to be interpretive in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it was supposed to sort of basically mirror the Gold Rush experience, which for most people started in Seattle.
Right.
And you know, I guess I would say, in addition to interpretation, or maybe in connection with interpretation, a lot of it was sort of collaborative museum exhibitry.
Right, that's what I was doing.
And, you know, making sure that we were kind of communicating similar messages and so on. And I think we were doing that. You know, I think there was, I mean, certainly if you came from Klondike in Skagway and showed up in Seattle and walked in the door, you felt very at home.
Yeah.
You know, they were telling the same story. But I think there could be more progress there. There was a guy, kind of a chief of interpretation at Klondike Seattle. I think his name was Mark Blackburn.
Oh yeah, and then Sean O'Meara.
Yeah, and I didn't know Sean so much, but Mark was there.
Right.
And you know, Mark, I think he definitely wanted to do more between Seattle and Skagway. I think he was feeling like he wasn't getting as much support from higher up in his own organization as he would have liked. But yeah, interpretively, and in terms of exhibits, I think there was a pretty good collaboration there. I just think it was envisioned, I'd have to go back and read the legislation
right.
again.
But no, I think you're right.
I think it was envisioned to be more of a seamless partnership than what it actually has ended up being.
Yeah, I believe you're correct in that. One thing we had talked a little bit about when we were on a break is the management of the Chilkoot Trail, and wondering that as superintendent, how much of an involvement you had with that, or were you focused more on the in-town parts?
Well, I tried to have a lot of involvement with it. You know, I certainly wanted to be personally involved. You know, I would hike the trail every year, and sometimes more than once. And, you know, I was such a goody two-shoes Boy Scout at the time. I mean, as I recollect, I was hiking it on my own time. You know, I was like taking my weekends and going to do it. I wasn't really doing it on work time, which I would have had every legitimate right to do. So anyway, you know, I just felt very committed to that operation and committed to working closely with Parks Canada. Ken East, who at the time was the regional director up in Whitehorse, became a good friend, still is a friend, retired now, lives in Ontario. But I loved working with Ken. Bob Lewis was kind of my sort of direct counterpart. Bob and I, at least initially, for whatever reason, you know, didn't really work as closely together as I would have liked. But I think over the 4 years that I was there, you know, that got to be a closer and closer relationship. And it was kind of unfortunate that I left when I did, because I think we would have had a chance to, you know, kind of solidify things even more had I stayed there longer. But, you know, I think I worked very closely on the Chilkoot Trail. We had a lot of issues with our trail rangers there who were, they were non-commissioned trail rangers. So, in other words, they weren't certified as law enforcement rangers. They didn't carry weapons. They didn't go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center to, you know, get all the training that law enforcement rangers get. But, you know, they were an integral part of our trail operation. You know, we had some challenges during the time I was there because the Park Service was getting more and more into the law enforcement business. And a lot of these trail rangers felt like they were going to be required to become commissioned rangers and have to go to FLETC. And some of them really didn't want to do that. They were happy doing what they were doing. And so we had, you know, we had some people who actually left, as I recall. They were all seasonal employees. Right. But some of them had been coming back for years and years and years, and we really depended on them. And some of them left because they sort of thought, you know, we're going to have to get a commission. And, you know, as things have played out, I actually don't think they would have. But some of them felt like that was where things were going. So, you know, we had to work through issues with them. You know, we had search and rescue kind of things. We had enough time. I could, you know, tell some great stories. There were some, you know, very vivid recollections I have about some unusual things that happened in terms of people being lost. And then, of course, the maintenance part of it was another huge part of the trail operation. We had the trail crews, and, you know, I don't remember exactly. I think they worked like 8 days on, 10-hour days, and then they had like 4 or maybe even 6 days off. But, you know, during their 8 days, they were kind of living up the trail, right. You know, and really doing important work in terms of keeping the trail operating and so on. And, you know, trying to make sure that we were doing that in a collaborative way with Parks Canada, and that kind of the quality of the experience that you got on the Alaska side was going to be matched by the quality of the experience on the Canadian side was, you know, part of what I think we were all after. And I think we did a pretty good job of achieving that. You know, one of the big things that I remember sort of getting dragged over the coals about by our regional office was that, you know, the sheep camp, campground was not a good place to have a campground. It was right along a glacial braided river, and you know the river would jump its channel and you know change its course and so on and so forth. And you know there just wasn't a lot of other places for that campground to be in that particular spot that would have been sort of out of the floodplain. And one year we had a flood, and it, you know, it created some real issues. There was kind of some new channels cut that sort of ran through what had been the existing trail, and there were people that ended up having to kind of like ford the stream in order to continue up the trail. And the magnitude of the problem was not something that really became immediately obvious to me. And it took a while to understand, that we were actually dealing with a serious situation. Now, luckily, everything worked out fine. Nobody was injured or harmed or anything. But the flood definitely created some issues. And, you know, Rob Arnberger, again, regional director at the time, tough guy. And he's kind of like, well, you should have been on that. You know, why didn't you tell me more about that? And, you know, why weren't you more proactive? Well, you know, the reason was, it was 12 miles up the trail, and it wasn't clear to me how serious it was until after it had actually gone on a good ways. I think I've heard that subsequently they moved the location of that campground, which really needed to be done for a whole bunch of different reasons. So I think that was ultimately a good thing, but I felt like I was, you know, really involved. You couldn't help but be. It was a, you know, really big part of the job during the summer season was keeping everything on track with the Chilkoot Trail.
You mentioned search and rescue. Can you tell, you know, one of those incidents? The one that stands out in your mind?
The one that comes most vividly to mind was... It was almost kind of an overlap between, a personal situation and people getting lost. There was a woman who was roughly 40 years old who was coming to Alaska, and, you know, was she having a midlife crisis? Was there some reason she was making the trip? I don't really know. On the ferry coming to Alaska, she met up with a guy who was literally about half her age, and, seemingly... They became an item. They walked off the trail, and I'm forgetting the name of the location, but there was a place where you can kind of cut out on a little island along the trail where there's a bunch of old...
Canyon City?
Could have been, yeah. And when they walked back in there, one of them left their backpack along the trail, which was a major no-no. You were never supposed to leave your backpack unattended because of bears.
Right.
And you didn't want them to become a bear attraction. So one of our trail rangers went by, saw the pack, left a note on it, said, you need to reclaim this pack. Lickety-split. Well, at the end of the day, the trail ranger was hiking back through there again, and the pack was still there. And he's like, this is odd. Well, it turned out that this couple, if you will, had somehow gotten lost. And the odd thing about it that I never really totally understood was that it appeared that the whole time that they were lost, they were kind of right between the trail and the Taya River. and how they were not able to kind of find their way back to the trail or even to yell out loud for help and have somebody respond, I do not totally understand. It never made sense to me. But, you know, they were lost at least overnight. And I remember our chief ranger, Reed McCluskey, actually had to call the woman's husband in the middle of the night and basically say, we can't find your wife. And he's like, oh, well, that's not good. Do you have any reason to know why your wife might be in the company of a male named so-and-so? Not only do I have no reason to know that, I'm really upset to hear that. So, you know, it became a little bit of a soap opera. Eventually they were found, and, you know, I don't know what happened from there. We got, you know, got them back to safety, and that was kind of the end of our involvement in it. But, you know, there were things like that that would happen.
Helicopter rescues of injured hikers?
There were helicopter rescues. Yes, there was I remember a story, and I think this happened before I got there, but a helicopter rescue where somebody had not kind of anchored down an oxygen tank when the helicopter took off. And, you know, if an oxygen tank gets the head of it knocked off, I mean, they can explode. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a huge big deal. There was a particular seasonal employee who I think was involved with that who didn't continue to be a seasonal employee too much longer just because of the, you know, the magnitude of the issue there. But yes, helicopter rescues, you know, some issues with people with dogs on the trail, dogs off leash and so on, which they were not supposed to be. And, you know, the fear was always that somebody's dog would get out of sight. It would see a bear, the bear would chase the dog would run back to his owner, and that, you know, you'd have some kind of episode. The other issue that I remember becoming increasingly problematic during my time there was just the number of kind of ultra athletes that would basically thru-hike and even run the whole Chilkoot Trail, you know, meaning that they were basically running all night. And, you know, even around the solstice time in the summer, you're far enough south in Skagway that you do have a little bit of night. And, you know, there's always a concern about that and people being out when wildlife are out and, you know, issues that that might create if somebody were attacked or whatever. You know, luckily, in reality, the number of issues on the Chilkoot Trail, and I'll tell you this since you're planning to hike it, you know, the issues were really minimal. And a lot of the things that people did that went wrong were just like really, really dumb things that people did. But overall, you know, I think it was a well-run operation that really went along pretty smoothly the vast majority of the time.
You had mentioned something about getting daily trail reports.
Yes.
Yeah. The rangers would report in to the headquarters?
Yeah, I think they did like a morning report and then like an evening report. There's a particular name for the evening report that I'm not quite recollecting right now. But, yeah, that was a part of the whole trail operation. And, you know, somebody would call in from the trail center. Somebody would call in from, the park service, probably at sheep camp. Somebody would call in from Lindeman City. So, you know, you sort of had coverage along the whole length of the trail. And, you know, you get weather information and the number of people that were going to be on the trail on a given day. And, you know, it was always kind of interesting. And it really was sort of the driving force of the rhythm of the park in a lot of ways during the summer months. So, yeah, I was always kind of really dialed into that. I liked it. And, you know, I missed it when the season would end.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to quickly ask you about was the White Pass unit.
Yeah.
And what in anything during your time happened there in terms of management or surveying? Or...
You know, it was always kind of unknown territory. And it was, in a way, it was kind of ironic because on the one side you had the Klondike Highway and on the other side you have the White Pass and Yukon Railroad route, but in between you had the White Pass unit. And it was extremely difficult to get into, you know, even though you had sort of modern transportation all around it. I don't know that I ever really got deeply into the White Pass unit. I know we would have some trail rangers, Chilkoot trail rangers, who occasionally would kind of go on a patrol in the White Pass unit to see what was going on there. I do, and I'm not remembering the details, but I do remember as time went by during my tenure there, I was feeling more and more like, we should have a presence here. You know, there was a lot of archaeological artifacts, things that needed to be protected there, and it just never really seemed to me that we had enough of a presence there. I would hear stories that were never actually confirmed, but I have no reason to doubt their veracity, that people were illegally hunting in the White Pass unit. You know, we never really had enough of a presence there to, you know, address that situation. So, yeah, there were a lot of issues in the White Pass unit you would have liked to have been able to spend more time on. And generally, just because of lack of staff, lack of money, and so on and so forth, you know, we just didn't put a lot of resources into that area, unfortunately.
Is that something you could envision being developed more?
Well, you know, I mean, if there's a will, there's a way, right? And if there's enough money, it could always happen. You know, I guess I could potentially see something being done in partnership with the railroad if they wanted to work with the Park Service. And, you know, I know the railroad will make whistle stops kind of along the way there and drop people off, you know, heading up to Lawton Glacier mm-hmm. and so on. And, you know, I think if you go the other direction, you can get into the White Pass unit. And, you know, if there were stairs constructed or something that would make access into the White Pass unit more viable, you know, I think those kind of things could happen. Would they be good things? You know, that becomes a little debatable. You know, on the one hand, having more of a Park Service presence there could be a good thing in terms of a higher level of protection for the area. But having more of a visitor presence there could be a bad thing. And, you know, it could be creating more impacts. It could be leading to some of the same kind of commercialization that we talked about earlier that wasn't always a good thing. You know, I think you'd, I don't know, you know, what level of access the public has to White Pass today. I think if there was a decision made to increase that level of access, I think you'd have to be very careful and deliberate about it, because, you know, you wouldn't want unintended consequences to come out of it.
Well, you mentioned the railroad, and I had wanted to ask you about the relationship with the park and the railroad. You had talked about working with the city, so what was your relationship with the White Pass Railroad and their operations?
Yeah. Can we take a pause real quick?
Okay, so we're going to see the relationship with the White Pass Yukon Railroad.
You know, I always felt like it was a good relationship. I think I alluded to this earlier. It always seemed like there was a little bit of drama within the White Pass hierarchy, and, you know, people coming into favor, people falling out of favor, so on and so forth. But, you know, that was kind of their own internal stuff that you would just hear about. As far as working with them, you know, I always felt like it was a good relationship. When I first got there, the head guy at the railroad was a guy named Fred McCorston. I know Fred had come kind of from the Seattle area. I don't remember exactly what his background was, but I think he was kind of a business person, basically. And, you know, I liked Fred. He was a good guy to work with. You know, I think my wife and I had a little bit of social interaction with he and his wife, and it always seemed to me... Oh, sorry.
You have to take that?
Yeah. She's just wondering about lunch and so on.
About White Pass.
Yeah, Fred McCorston was a good guy. We socialized with he and his wife to a certain degree. He was very engaged in things in the community. You know, I always liked Fred. I think at some level, he ended up having a bit of a falling out. You know, I don't know exactly what that was about. He ended up leaving. The guy who I think came in next after him was Gary somebody, and I'm not remembering Gary's last name right now, but I can picture him very clearly. And Gary was a good guy. You know, I always you know, I always had a good relationship with him. And
what kind of issues did the Park Service and White Pass work on together? What were your, I mean, was it their clients coming into the park? I mean, I don't know what you would have needed to work together on.
Well, you know, for one thing, we were next door neighbors. You know, their headquarters was right next to our headquarters, so you know, that gave us sort of a connectedness. I also think that what was I going to say? My brain is starting to get a little tired here, but you know, their clients were cruise ship passengers.
Right.
And those were our clients as well. So I think there was a lot of connectedness around that issue too. You know, I don't remember kind of any specific things that we really worked on together, but they were such a part of the history of the community that, you know, before I had gotten there, they had a Gold Rush Centennial event in 1998 that had been a big kind of community event, and I know White Pass was involved with that and, you know, organizing some kind of like dignitary train rides and things of that sort. And, well, of course, the other thing that we would really coordinate with them on was the Chilkoot Trail, because most of the Chilkoot Trail hikers are going to finish at Lake Bennett and then they're going to get on the train and come back to Skagway that way. So there was definitely a lot of coordination around the Chilkoot Trail, and you know, our numbers in terms of the number of people that were going over the Chilkoot Pass and hiking the trail on any given day were of interest to them, because it had to do with, you know, passengers coming back to Skagway.
They needed enough seats on the train.
They needed enough seats. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So yeah, there was a lot of coordination there, and I think it worked pretty well. Yeah.
You had mentioned the Rasmussen family, and the Rasmussen Foundation was involved with the Rapuzzi collection.
Yes.
Were you involved with any of that negotiating and obtaining of that collection?
I was. You know, I remember being in Anchorage one time. Again, Rob Arnberger was the regional director, and I said to him, you know, just kind of casually, I said, it'd really be nice if we could go over and meet, I'm forgetting his first name, Mr. Rasmussen.
Was Elmer Rasmussen still alive?
Think so. Yeah, I think it was Elmer. And, you know, I said, I thought it would be good for you as a regional director to have a relationship with him. And Rob was kind of like, let's go. And I'm like, right now? And he's like, yeah, no time like the present. So, you know, we actually went over and met with him. You know, as I recall, it was a pretty cordial meeting, but as I recall, I think Mr. Rasmussen, you know, like a lot of old-time Alaskans, I think he had a lot of issues with the federal government. And so, I think we spent some amount of time hearing about what some of those issues were. But, you know, then eventually... And I remember Rob Arnberger, I think, was kind of graceful in how he handled this, because, you know, he eventually just kind of turned it around and said, well, so maybe we've had some challenges in the past, but let's talk about how we can work together on this Rapuzzi collection. So it kind of migrated in that direction. And so, you know, I think that was basically kind of the very formative stages of the relationship. Some of the other things that were happening during my time there, I mean, Phyllis Brown, who owned the Rapuzzi collection, I knew Phyllis really well. I liked her. Phyllis was, you know, a little bit of a character, personality, but, you know, I never had any difficulty working with her. We did an appraisal of the museum collection, and this was kind of, you know, an early step in the acquisition process. And, you know, it's like getting an appraisal of your house. You know, somebody can always question, is that really the value? How do you know that? You know, we brought in people who were accredited appraisers. You know, they had all kinds of certifications. They came up with an appraised value for the entire collection. And my recollection is that it was somewhere like right around $150,000 is what they said it was worth. And it got to a point where we were getting late in the fiscal year and we were going to have that much money in end of year money. And so I remember calling up Phyllis Brown and basically saying, Phyllis, we've got the money to buy this from you right now at the appraised value. Well, there were a lot of issues in Phyllis's mind. I think number one, she wondered whether the appraised value was actually accurate. And there was something that I'm not totally recalling, but there was something that had been put out in Congress. There's an authorization part of legislation, but then there's the appropriation part of it. Mm-hmm. So they can say whatever they want in the authorization part, but until they actually appropriate money, well, the authorization language can become meaningless. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, the authorization language that had come out at some point said something to the effect that the National Park Service is authorized to acquire the Rapuzzi collection at values up to $500,000. Well, our appraiser had said that it wasn't worth that much. But Phyllis, at that time, she continued to think that we had $500,000 and that I was holding out on her. And I kept saying, Phyllis, this is not an appropriation. We do not have that $500,000. Well, so it was kind of like a cat chasing its tail. And ultimately, that didn't work. It was really kind of a shot in the dark. At the time, I realized it was a real, real long shot. But I figured I'd take a chance at it and just see if we had an easy solution. Well, that didn't work out. And I think from there, the relationship with the Rasmussen Foundation continued to develop to the point where after I left, with help from the Rasmussen Foundation, the park was able to acquire the whole collection.
Do you know whose idea it was to ask the Rasmussen Foundation for the financial assistance?
I don't remember exactly. I know there had been a lot of talk for a long time among a lot of people about the Park Service eventually acquiring that collection. I know that. As I said, Teresa Thibault had history with the Rasmussen Foundation. She knew Elmer. She could call him up. Now, did she actually was she the one who instigated the idea of working with the Rasmussen Foundation, or did that kind of come from a variety of different places? I don't really recall. I don't recall. I just know that, they had history in Skagway with, they had a bank there that eventually was bought out by Wells Fargo, but, they had connections in the community, and it had just been discussed that, they would be a potential philanthropic partner.
And so, yeah, your role, it was during the early days of the negotiations.
I would say that, although, it wasn't too much longer after I left that they actually acquired the collection. So, I think that things had progressed relatively far during the time I was there. I just think what ended up needing to happen in a little more depth was the culmination of the relationship between the Park Service and the Rasmussen Foundation that would allow all that to happen. And I do not know, what the collection was ultimately purchased for. I would expect that Phyllis Brown probably did the right thing in holding out, because I think she probably ended up getting more than the approximately $150,000 that I was offering her based on that appraised value. But I really don't know exactly what that value was. I just think it was a good thing for the Park Service. And, Phyllis was not really able to manage that collection. It was a bunch of stuff squirreled away here, squirreled away there, old buildings that she was not in a position to take care of. She was getting up there in years. I think she's still alive. I'm not really sure. But you know, I think it was good for her, and I think it was good for the Park Service and the American public that we were ultimately able to acquire that collection.
Great. Looking at your time in Skagway, are there things you can say or you consider your successes?
Well, you know, one of the big successes is what I've already talked about. I think our financial position there just improved tremendously during my time there. And I'd like to think that I sort of brought some kind of sensibility about good business practices to the job that ultimately benefited the park. You know, I think laying the foundation for the acquisition of that acreage along the Chilkoot Trail that I talked mm-hmm. about, that was huge. You know, laying the foundation for the acquisition of the Rapuzzi collection. You know, another thing that I really haven't talked about, but that kind of sticks out in my mind as sort of a signature accomplishment, was the 25th anniversary celebration that we had in 2001, you know, celebrating the creation of the park. And what I remember vividly about that is when I came from Harpeth Ferry National Historical Park, where that was like a park that excelled at hosting events. You know, we were really, really good at it. And I had just sort of come to take that as almost second nature, as something that the National Park Service did and did well. And I remember in a staff meeting saying to our management team that I really thought we needed to start working on a 25th anniversary celebration to acknowledge the history of the park and the town. And pretty much to a person, I was told, that is a really bad idea. You know, there's a lot of people here who still have hard feelings about the Park Service being in this community. You know, you're going to give them a voice. You know, that is not a good idea. And I basically said, well, we're going to do it anyway. You know, we're not going to shine or hide our light under a bushel basket. You know, we're going to let our light shine. And it ended up just being spectacular. We had a beautiful bluebird, clear sky day in June. We had great attendance. We had good participation by local people, Stan Selmer, Barbara Kalin, who I'd be surprised if Barbara was still alive. Because she was definitely up there in years at that time. Our regional director was there, Rob Armberger. Ken East was there from Parks Canada.
What kind of events did you do?
The Chilkat dancers were there from Haines. What we basically tried to do as much as we could was to sort of follow the order of events that was used when they originally dedicated the park. They had a kind of a ceremony at that mm-hmm. time. And we had copies of the agenda for that. And so we tried to, you know, do some of the same things. And like the Chilkat dancers, for example, they had been involved in that original park sort of dedication event. So we brought them back. And, you know, it was just basically to sort of highlight the role that the park had played in the Skagway community. And it was just spectacularly successful. It went off without a hitch. And I was, you know, I was so glad about it, partly because I was met with such skepticism at the beginning, but partly because I thought it actually built goodwill for the park, you know, rather than the reverse, which I think is what some people were fearing. So, yeah, just a really spectacular thing.
Did you feel any of that animosity while you were living in Skagway that, oh, you're a Park Service, we don't like the park?
You know, you could look at that in different ways. There was a one member of the community who had a license plate that said FTNP, and it was basically FTNPS. F-word, the National Park Service. And he was a big, scary guy that you would see around town. You know, I don't think I would say hello to him. I don't think I ever had a more in-depth conversation with him than that. You know, there was some vestiges of that. I do remember one time we had our car parked out on the street and it got vandalized. I remember one time somebody took like a gallon, a glass gallon jug and broke it on our driveway. You know, Skagway in the summertime was kind of a party town. Were there people who had just had too much fun and just kind of happened to do this stuff? Maybe. Was it directed at me as park superintendent? Maybe. You know, I don't know. It's kind of hard to know. But to me, those kind of things were really isolated. You know, there were still, I guess, what you might call some old-time Alaskans who did harbor ill will towards the federal government. But politically speaking, Skagway was a pretty progressive place. You know, I would say much, much more so than Alaska as a whole. And, you know, I think we always felt pretty well accepted there. And that was a nice thing about being there, was that, you know, for the most part, you felt supported.
Well, that's good. Looking back, anything you think of as failures or regrets or things you wish you had been able to accomplish and were not able to?
Well, you know, nothing catastrophic and, you know, really nothing that we haven't talked about already. You know, I would have liked to have seen a little more harmony among the management team of the park. Mm-hmm. You know, that certainly would have been one thing. I definitely would have liked to have never had to move that ice house and to really feel like, you know, the business community was more accepting of the absolute necessity of preserving the historic character of Skagway, Alaska. You know, that was something that I would have liked to have seen more progress on for sure. You know, I'm sure there are other things here and there, but, you know, when I think back on my time in Skagway, I think positive things. You know, I have a really good feeling about the time that I spent there and fond memories of the beauty of the place and, you know, all the work that we were able to do there. You know, I think about the good things.
And then after Skagway, you've gone on to do other superintendencies?
I have, yeah.
So what did you do? Did you come directly here to Black Canyon?
Well, no, I came directly to Colorado National Monument, which is kind of, you know, right outside our door here. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I love Colorado National Monument. It's a fabulous place, and I felt very grateful to be able to come here. I think sort of in other ways, it almost felt a little bit to me like a step down. You know, we did not have the budget here that we had at Klondike Gold Rush. We did not have the level of visitation. We did not have the number of employees. You know, there's political challenges in this valley. You know, there are people here who are as unsupportive of the federal government as they are in Alaska. And so, you know, it's not necessarily an easy ride here at Colorado National Monument, but I felt like it was an easier ride. You know, it to me was like, geez, I'm ready for something more. So, yeah, I was here for like 3 years. I ended up going to Chickasaw National Recreation Area in Oklahoma. And in that job, I also oversaw the Park Service staff at the Oklahoma City National Memorial, and I supervised the superintendent at Ouachita Battlefield National Historic Site out in western Oklahoma. So I was kind of over everything that the Park Service did in Oklahoma. So that was kind of fun. Oklahoma is definitely a hard place to work. You know, the politics there, in my mind, were tougher than the Alaska politics in terms of doing federal business in the conservation arena. So it was a hard place to be, but, you know, a rewarding place. And then from there, I went to Black Canyon, the Gunnison, and Kirikani National Recreation
Area. And so you've been superintendent at Gunnison for how long?
I got there at the, let me think now, it would have been the tail end of 2014.
Okay. And then you're getting close to retirement, I guess.
Well, you know, you never know, you know, what else might come along, but, you know, we love this area, and, you know, I moved so much during my career and I've had to leave places that I really loved, and that's hard to do. And you know, I think we'll probably end up making a commitment to staying here rather than looking at moving somewhere mm-hmm. else.
So the things that you learned at your first superintendency in Skagway that you were able to apply to your other positions?
Well, I think mostly just being community oriented, because it seemed to me that was really what was needed so much when I first got to Klondike Gold Rush. And trying to be involved in the community, not just in terms of Park Service things going on, but just as a citizen, being involved in community cleanups and, being a member of the Elks Club and, going to dinners and, bringing food to dinners and, just sort of being a part of the community, that was something that really seemed like it was a necessity at Klondike Gold Rush, and I've tried to maintain those things during my subsequent time as a superintendent, and I think it really helps. I think in some places those things are met with more receptivity than they are in other places, but I think being community oriented is probably the biggest thing that I got out of the experience at Klondike Gold Rush.
Great. Is there anything else that we have not talked about that you had in mind from our emails and questions I'd sent you in advance?
Only just that it was hard to leave. It was extremely hard to leave. I've never been back to Alaska since we got on the ferry right around Memorial Day in 2004. I've always said I was an Alaskan long before I got there, and I'll still be an Alaskan long after I leave. And I still feel that way. I've alluded to it a little bit, but I did not feel a high level of support as time went on from Rob Arnberger as regional director and then Marcia Blazak when she became regional director. It kind of began to seem to me that even though Alaska is a huge, big state, it was a little too small. And it seemed like it was the time to make a move. But it was a really hard thing. If I went back to Klondike Gold Rush, and I will someday, if I went back there today, I'd have a really hard time going into the park headquarters. I do not know if I could do it. It would be extremely difficult because I put so much emotion into it, and I work so hard to try to do the right things there that I've sort of got a memory of it as it was. And I kind of want that to be how I always remember it. Mm-hmm. And if I walked into the building and saw, oh, well, this is different, and that's different, and they moved this and did that, and it would be like, it'd be hard to take.
But it's not a question of not wanting to go back because you felt like you were mistreated.
It was not wanting to go back because I loved it so much. And wanting it to be just exactly how I remember it. And having a little bit of a hard time wrestling with the idea of it maybe not being exactly how I remember it. So, it was a hard decision to leave there. It was a great place. I understand why my predecessor stayed there as long as he did. Mike Trunnell, who just recently left there, I think he was there for a good long time. It's an easy place to be comfortable.
Yeah.
It's a very nice place. Community and it's a great park. So yeah, my memories of Skagway are overwhelmingly positive.
Well, I appreciate all of your time today. I've had you talking a long time, and I know it's lunchtime now.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well,
unless there's
you, Karen.
Anything else you want to conclude with?
No, I think we've covered the landscape. I
all
appreciate
right.
it.
Great, thanks.